Don't get left in the dark. Let us shine a light on everything you need to know. This is Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Tonight, Brent Gunning, Matt Marchese alongside me, switching out some new line combinations here. Haven't got to do this too often with you, Matt, but fired up to be here tonight. I don't know how spooky an addition we want to make it on the verge of Halloween here, but how you doing tonight, Matt?
Excellent, Brent. It has been a long time. It's been at least a month since we last worked together. So, like you said, changing up the lines, but ready to rock and roll.
Yeah, so let's start with a little Hallows Eve. I don't know about you. For me, I kind of fluctuate on this holiday. In years past, I've often referred to myself as the Grinch of Halloween because, boy, I get way too upset about seeing a grown adult in costume at work. What about you? Do you like the holiday? Are you a little Grinchy with it like me? Where do you stand?
Okay, so I'm fine with it. Like, I have no problem handing out candy to the kids. Actually, I haven't been able to do it the last couple of years because I've actually worked on Halloween the last couple of years being on the air. But the adults at work thing really kind of irks me. I know it happens at our place of work, and I just kind of look at it like, you might be a little bit too old to be wearing a costume there. Mm-hmm. I've never really liked Halloween to begin with because I never really had good costumes, so it was always kind of just an afterthought for me and just go out, get some free candy, and go home. So, yeah, no, I'm not a big fan of the holiday personally, but to hand out, you know, candy to the kids, I got no problem with that.
I got to be honest, I'm a little bit bummed. You know, I've made a big step in my life. I've moved out of the big city, moved to, still a city, but a smaller one. And I was all fired up to hand out some candy to the kiddies. They were going to be here in their costumes. And I don't even know if that's going to be a thing this year. I mean, I guess you have to be safe before anything else. But yeah, I'm right there with you, a little bit bummed out. Now, last thing before we actually discuss a little bit of sports. If when it comes to Halloween candy, are you more of a chocolates or more of a sweets kind of guy?
That's a good one. I was always partial to, do you remember the candy Big Feet?
Yes, the red guys.
Okay, so Big Feet and Swedish berries, I was always partial to. Like me some cherry blasters and sour peaches, fuzzy peaches. But I'm more of a chocolate guy. So before, in my previous incarnation in this world, I used to work for my dad who used to own a vending company. So I was very well versed in every sort of candy that was out there because I used to fill the machines. I used to physically go and I was a route driver. So, but I was always more of a chocolate guy. Always more of a chocolate guy.
Yeah, I feel like I've come around a little more to chocolate as I've grown a little older and a little grayer, but I still have such a nasty sweet tooth. I may have gone and picked up some Halloween candy, and I may have set a massive bag of Sour Patch Kids aside, but I don't know. These are all hypotheticals. I can't really confirm there. Yeah, we'll see how much of that candy makes its way to the neighborhood children tomorrow. Obviously, Halloween coming up tomorrow night. Wherever you are, please do it safely. I think there's a way to do that. So whatever is being suggested for you, try to find a way to do it safe because that's definitely the important thing at this time of year. So let's actually talk a little bit about sports. Some Blue Jays news coming down today. They say no thanks to Chase Anderson, $9.5 million next year. Rafael Dolis coming back at $1.5 million. Either of those moves surprise you at all, Matty?
Not really. No, the Anderson one, you look at it and say, yeah, okay, nine and change million. No, we don't need that around. There's other options that we have to fill out the starting rotation, and there's free agency still. They may you know, circle back with Chase Anderson and get him on a cheaper deal after the year he had. So that was a smart move by the Jays. And the Dolis thing was an absolute no-brainer. He was one of their more consistent relievers over the course of the year. maybe not the biggest fan of how slow he works on some nights when we're trying to get on the air, but as you very well know. But that was a no-brainer for the money that he makes. And Mark Shapiro said it in his end-of-year availability that they probably aren't going to spend a lot of money this year. So with that being said, you're going to have to fill out with guys like Rafael Dolis at $1.5 million, and that's a good bit of business for me.
Rafael Dolis playing defense against two things, that is opposing hitters and us getting on after Blue Jays games. Yeah, Sam McKee always says it. You're not going to like it. It's not going to be pretty. But when it's over, you're going to be thrilled usually at how it went with Dolis. You don't like to watch it. But yeah, it works out pretty well for them. I think the one thing fans kind of have to like to see, or at least I think we'll expect to see, we'll see, is that that $9.5 million, they're going to want it spent on somebody, and you're going to need to add to that starting rotation. I don't think anybody, you know, saw Chase Anderson and said, yeah, let's sign him up again. But you're going to now have to take that money and convert it into players that can actually help your team, because I think we all know not to read too much into the 60-game season, but there was definitely a lot of positives that you can hopefully build on heading into 2021. I got to talk to you about this. I know it's been a couple of days since it happened, but this whole Justin Turner incident, him going on the field afterwards, I can't say I'm at all surprised by it, but I certainly understand a bit of the vitriol finding his way. Where are you at on Justin Turner back on the field despite his COVID diagnosis?
Well, I'll echo the sentiments of Jeff Blair on Writer's Block the other day, and that is, it's very fitting for 2020 that an athlete tests positive for COVID during a game, wins a championship, and goes out onto the field, because it is very much like society in that there are people that are out there that say, well, this virus isn't going to get me, and I'm better than everybody else, so I don't care about anybody else's feelings or their health or what have you, and I'm going to go do what I'm going to go do. And that is basically 2020 in a nutshell as it pertains to this virus. Am I surprised? Not one bit, because it's kind of a general overlook at athletes as a whole, but there are some bad apples. But a lot of athletes, professional athletes, think that they are above a lot of things. They are seemingly invincible in their minds. And I have a feeling that played into effect a little bit when it came to Justin Turner. It's not a good look. And I know the guy's turning 35, and maybe some people will use age as an excuse if he doesn't sign right away or whatever, because he is a free agent. And I'll ask our two baseball guests on the show this tonight, but I wonder how much that will affect Justin Turner and the suitors that he has for free agency. Maybe I'm being cynical here, but I wonder how much that plays into people's minds.
I think what it'll do in terms of his availability or how quickly he'll be able to find a team, I think it eliminates the first day of free agency splash signing of Justin Turner. I don't think any team wants to link themselves to him all that quickly, but I don't know that it'll keep him off anyone's roster who wanted to go pay him. Now, the one thing I guess the question I find myself asking, and I know my answer for this, but I'll ask you, is who do you kind of put the blame to for this? Is it Major League Baseball's fault? Is it Justin Turner? Is it some combination of the two? Because for me, I lay the blame pretty squarely at the feet of Major League Baseball, no differently than if a toddler is acting up in a restaurant. Yeah, I mean, I guess it's the kid's fault, but we all know who's getting the blame, and it's the parents. And that's kind of the way I see it with Justin Turner. It's like Major League Baseball had to understand this was a possibility. I know we all think in the grand scheme of things, everyone's going to do the right thing, but it felt like they just had no contingency plan in place for that scenario happening.
Just when you think they've thought of everything, they have thought of nothing. That's kind of how that's how we approach 2020 at this point. Like, yeah, anything can happen, but you have to be ready for anything to happen. And that was one of those scenarios. And honestly, I think the blame goes everywhere. I think the majority of the blame has to fall on Justin Turner, because he was the one who made the decision to go out there and put others in danger. Now, having said that, Major League Baseball, I don't know what they could have done in the moment, but I can almost assure you that they are going to do something about it after the moment. There's got to be a suspension or a fine or something coming down. The Dodgers are also kind of complicit in this, because
for sure,
although we don't know exactly what was said to Justin Turner, we don't know who knew about it in terms of the other players. Like, we don't know a whole heck of a lot right now, and I'm sure most of that will come out. But the Dodgers got to be on the hook for some of this as well, for just not holding him back, saying, hey, like, you can't go out there. Because the Dodgers are going to get fined or have some sort of punishment levied against them in the aftermath as well. So they're going to suffer. I would assume it's going to be something financial, is my guess. But it's Justin Turner that made the decision to go out there. I don't know how much the team could have actually held him back from going out there. Like, what can you do? Restrain the guy? Like, put him in handcuffs? I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. But Justin Turner made the decision to go out there and put others in danger, so that falls on him.
I mean, if it was a hockey team, you just go the old Mighty Ducks route like they did with Goldberg and just tape him to a net you have hanging around back there. I guess you can't do that
exactly.
In baseball. But it all comes down to, you said it, is the reason I keep coming back to laying the blame at the feet of Major League Baseball is because they're the upper echelon level of all of this. Does Justin Turner deserve to take some blame? Of course. He's an adult and he made his decision. Do the Dodgers, should they take some blame? Yeah, of course. They allowed it. They were complicit in all of it. Great word by you. But it just comes back to baseball, assuming that it wouldn't get to this point. And I think that that's where you have your contingencies. If you have it written in the rules that if a player tests positive well in the game, they must leave the building it within the next whatever. Like, you have to codify these things. And I think what we've learned a lot in 2020, and sports is just one small section that's learned this, is don't assume just because it's a norm or people normally do it that the rules will be followed to that T. I think we've got to codify these things a little bit. But yeah, obviously, that was a scary situation. Not so much for the Dodgers. They won. We'll see how scary it is going forward to them. And that leads me into a lovely poll question. You threw out there tonight, Matt, and you can follow him on Twitter at MattSN590. On the air tonight with Gutting590. Hey, that's me. Since it's almost Halloween, what's the scariest thing for a Toronto sports fan? Is it A, long-term injury for Matthews, long-term injury for Lowry, Game 7 versus the Bruins, or any series at the Trop? And winning right now with 48% of the vote is Game 7 versus the Bruins. Coming in second to that is a long-term Matthews injury. So I don't know if those are the two scariest things, or it says a lot about our listenership, but yeah, definitely Leafs fans very afraid of everything when it comes to your poll question.
Yeah, and I'm actually a little bit surprised that the Lowry one wasn't higher on the list, because there's also the chance that Fred VanVleet is in pack, so I guess we didn't hedge that. But somebody did write in, and they had an even better one than I had put out there, so I will not take the credit for it, but it was David tweeted us and said, losing Masai. And if I had put that in there, I have a feeling that might have been tops on the list in a very close race with Game 7 versus the Bruins, because clearly the Game 7 thing versus the Bruins, I'm actually surprised that it's not higher.
Yeah, I think that's like, in terms of the sports villains for this city, the big bad Bruins are still far and away number one. I don't know, whoever your top Halloween villain is. Maybe it's Jason Voorhees, maybe it's Freddy, who knows? But whoever that top guy is for you, yeah, the Bruins are certainly them. For me, I got to go with the Matthews injury, because it's kind of there. That's the one. I think we all agree that health presumed, this guy's going to be a generational talent, and he's going to get his 50-goal season, and he's going to get his 100 points, and hopefully one day the Leafs will even win a playoff series while that's happening. But it feels like the one thing that can derail that is an injury. We've already had the little scares with the back, I believe. So I think that's the one for me that would be that's where I would land on the poll.
Yeah, I just look at that. You're right. Matthews is that guy, and we have seen what happens when Matthews misses time in the past. He was robbed of a 50-goal season this year because of COVID and all that kind of stuff, but he's been injured before. This is nothing new that we haven't seen, and we've seen what happens when he is hurt. It's not pretty, and it's not pretty because the Leafs don't have depth or whatever, because they have depth, especially at that position, especially now, but you're talking about one of the 10 best players in the NHL. I don't know if he's in the top 5 yet, because, again, we haven't seen anything in the playoffs. But you could easily make the case that he is a top 10 player in the NHL. Any team that loses a top 10 player in the NHL for a significant period of time, that will really hurt you, unless you're the Pittsburgh Penguins, who somehow miraculously win with, like, me playing on the fourth line right wing. So, yeah, I could see the scariness of that, but there's something about the Bruins and Game 7 that this club cannot get over. I don't know what it is. It was like how the Senators were with the Leafs in the late 90s and early 2000s. Was it didn't matter how good the Senators could be, the President's Trophy winners, they could be whatever, second place. The Leafs could have been in seventh, and they still beat them. It's just one of those things in sports that you can't explain. It just doesn't make any sense.
I think, hopefully, this is a more hope, but I actually think there's some fact to back this up. I think Father Time has kind of taken care of the Bruins for the Leafs. I think that this whole layoff and everything, obviously, we know Pastrnak's banged up. Not that it's going to affect him for his career, but the machine cannot go on forever. It might feel like it can, but at some point in time, Bergeron and Chara are going to stop being the players they are. And then I think when that happens, the infrastructure in Boston will kind of cave around them, but we will see what happens there. Obviously, gotta talk about this tonight as well, and we will be talking a little more NHL as well. Greg Wyshynski will join us later on in the show, but we can't talk about this heading into this weekend without talking about a big Bills game. How big of a game for them? Not so much how big is the game, but how big of a referendum is it on this Bills team? We know they were expected to take care of business against the Jets last week, and they beat them, but boy, they did not convince many people of many things in that victory. Just what do you need to see from the Bills to kind of have you still believing in them after this game against the Patriots?
Well, the forever optimist in me would say that they just need to win, because it's basically for the division, this game, the way the Patriots have started, the way the Bills have started. Miami's kind of creeping up there, and I think Miami is actually the better team than New England is at this point, especially from what we've seen and with all the injuries. But having said that, the not-so-optimistic Bills fan in me says that they need to absolutely go out there and lay a spanking on the Patriots, or else there's going to be even more questions. The Patriots have their top two wide receivers out. They have a multitude of defensive players out, ranging from injuries to guys opting out due to COVID. Cam Newton's banged up. His shoulder doesn't look right. He may even still be feeling the after effects of COVID, which I'm guessing he does. So this whole team doesn't look good. They didn't look good against the Niners last week. It was paltry, the effort that they put out there. And the Bills have to go out and make a statement. They have to go out and win by 20-plus points. That's what I would expect. Now, the weather is not really in their favor, considering that there's going to be winds up to 30 miles per hour during the game. That's a lot of wind. So Josh Allen may have a strong arm, but he ain't Superman. So there's going to be a lot of running of the ball, and the Bills have not done that very well. So as it pertains to the Jets game, I know this is going to sound really homerish, but the offense actually wasn't that bad. They did get stopped on a couple of occasions that ended up in field goals, but they had a touchdown called back due to a call that was kind of BS in my mind. It was an illegal formation call that probably shouldn't have been called. And then Tyler Kroft did the Daniel Jones and was at the 20-yard line with daylight in front of him and fell on his face. And that was a guaranteed touchdown. So two touchdowns that probably should have been weren't. And that's not on the quarterback, in my opinion, who's actually played really well. Even in the losses, he's still completing, you know, over 65% of his passes. And there's a lot of question marks, yes, but I think more question marks are on the defensive side of the ball, because they have just been hemorrhaging yards to teams all season long.
Yeah, the defense kind of found its footing in this. Well, not kind of. They were absolutely dominant in the second half of that game against the Jets. But hey, it's the Jets, and I hear what you're saying when you point out those kind of two specific plays. But at the end of the day, you've got to be able to finish drives in this league. And if you can't finish them against the Jets, I don't know how you think you're going to be able to do that against the team that's even sniffing the playoffs. You talk about Josh Allen having a big, strong arm. I'd like him to have a strong brain and strong hands. I'd like to see him make just slightly better decisions. And said love to see that guy hang on to the ball. Josh Allen is one of the most enticing players in the league. You see it every single week, even last week, and as frustrating as that game was, you see it. It's right there, and now he's got this offensive coordinator, Dable, who's been able to scheme guys open. He's got a weapon in Diggs. He's got some semblance of a running game. It feels like it's all right there, and you know, yes, the excuse is going to be built in of, oh, the wind was howling. Well, you play in upstate New York, and you'd like to play deep into February or January. So it just feels like everything you said kind of makes sense there, but I need to see it from Allen, where I'm past the point of moral victories or, well, if this guy wouldn't have fallen or half, he could have got a toe down. No, just like, forget it. Make it happen. You played a terrible Jets team last week, and you're playing a, if they're not terrible, completely depleted New England team this week. That's where I'm at.
Yeah, and I am on board with all of that. I think the one guy that kind of goes unnoticed in this offense, and he's a huge part of what they do, and when you talk about Brian Daboll scheming guys open, I think not having John Brown basically for the last 3 weeks has, you've noticed it, because they don't want Diggs to stretch the field. They want Diggs to kind of be that mid-range, you know, 10 to 15 yard target, and John Brown they'll move him around the formation, and they'll stretch the field with him, which will open up things. Not having John Brown means that teams can play a lot more zone coverage, which Josh Allen has struggled against this season. It's no secret. The teams that have played well, Tennessee went to zone coverage against them. KC went to zone coverage against them. And the Jets are the Jets, whatever. But you look at what he did in those two games against two top teams that decided to play zone as opposed to playing man-to-man, it's made a huge difference. John Brown having that speed will open up defenses, and then they can't play zone anymore. They have to play man-to-man because they have to account for that speed. If they don't, the Bills will be able to stretch them out all day. So I think not having John Brown really hurts the Bills' offense, and he is back this week. He doesn't have an injury designation going into Sunday. So I think you'll notice that's going to be a huge thing. Listen, we know that New England's down a bunch of defensive players. There is no excuse for the Bills this Sunday. They need to go out and they need to lay a thumping, because God knows I do not want to see Sean McDermott go 0-7 against Bill Belichick with this god-awful team that the Patriots have.
Hear, hear. And you can hear that game on Sunday right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Pre-game starts up at 12:30. We'll have plenty of more NFL talk. The next example of that will be at 8 o'clock. Torrey Gurley, former NFL wide receiver, will join us. Also, Dan Fates, a sports anchor reporter with 13 Wham Sports in Buffalo. Lots of Bills talk coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. But when we continue on Sportsnet tonight, going to dive back into Major League Baseball, what's going on around the free agent market, and what's going on with the White Sox and Tony La Russa. We'll get into all that with June Lee of ESPN when we continue on Sportsnet tonight.
As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake doctor's orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Tonight, Brent Gunning, Matt Marchese alongside me. Very excited to talk a little bit of baseball now, dive back into things with June Lee, staff writer for ESPN. June, thanks for taking the time. How are you doing tonight?
How are you guys doing? Thank you guys for having me.
Okay, I'm doing pretty well, but I have to admit I'm a little perplexed. My brain is doing crazy things. What on earth are the White Sox doing with Tony La Russa, 76 years old, as their new manager? Like, what can you're very smart, you're very enlightened, you're steeped in the game of baseball, both old school and new school. What can you tell me to help me make sense of this? Because I don't get it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm honestly having a kind of hard time, similar to you, trying to figure out what's going on here, because when you look at that clubhouse, right, you have so many young, fun personalities that are also really, really good on the baseball field between Tim Anderson, Eloy Jimenez, Luis Robert, Lucas Giolito, Michael Kopech, the guy who's in the minor leagues, who's coming up for them, who also has a very big personality. This is a really, really fun, exciting young team, and so to bring in Tony La Russa, who hasn't managed since basically in a decade since the Cardinals, and has been bouncing around front offices for the last 10 years or so, For me, I mean, it not only just hiring Tony La Russa was kind of confusing, but beyond that, the fact that they also didn't interview anybody else for that job, pretty much, I just have a lot of questions about that process, because we're in a day and age where the game is changing incredibly rapidly at this point, just the way it's played on the field, and especially over the course of the last 5 years or so, I think we've seen just kind of a massive amount of change in terms of the amount of data and video that is available to players. And so the game has changed this massive amount over the course since the time that Tony La Russa hasn't managed a baseball team. I'm just kind of perplexed on so many different levels before I even start thinking about how this will even play out on the baseball field.
Yeah, the thing I come back to, and I don't think we've ever seen any indication to make us think Tony La Russa can be this guy, but I understand the idea of getting a you know, for lack of a better term, old school baseball man, I mean, massive air quotes going up here, to try to sell a new school, an analytics movement, or if you're trying to do that, but it feels like that's not going to be La Russa. He's been critical of the bat flip and the showing of the emotion in the game, and it would only kind of make sense to me if you wanted this to be the kind of like figurehead of your organization to kind of take away questions. Not that there shouldn't be some with him, but do you understand what I'm saying there?
Totally. And we can do this whole talking head thing where, you know, we can pretend like we know exactly what's going to happen when Tony La Russa actually takes over as manager of the Chicago White Sox, because obviously people can change and, you know, clubhouse dynamics are fluid and personalities can mesh in interesting ways, and people can, you know, try to evolve one way or the other. And so we can speculate all we want about that, right? And we just don't know what's going to happen. But, you know, at least on the surface, like, it's really hard to see just kind of these personalities meshing together well in the clubhouse, just given the demographic and just the I think there's just generation gap between, you know, Tony La Russa, the generation that he comes from, how he views the game, and how, you know, just as recently as this past year has shown, you know, with the Fernando Tatis home run, that he doesn't, you know, view that as, you know, the bat flip that I think is kind of celebrating today's game now. He's kind of part of a different generation where that's kind of viewed as unsportsmanlike. And so it's going to be incredibly interesting just to see how that human dynamic plays out of the course of the next White Sox season.
I would love to talk about Tony La Russa all night, because he actually does look like a surly prick too. Like, he would be the guy that you really don't want to play for, and it doesn't look like it works in Chicago right now with that young nucleus that they have. But I want to go in a different direction here, June. So they've announced that there's going to be no owners meetings, no winter meetings. I don't think there's any surprise there, but how do you think that might affect player activity, especially early on in free agency?
I think this is a question that a lot of teams are trying to wrap their heads around right now in terms of what is this offseason going to look like? Because, you know, there's so much discussion right now about, you know, how many fans are going to be able to come back next year. Just what is the world going to look like in 2021 in general? I think just given how rapidly things have changed, just given the current circumstances of the pandemic, it's kind of hard to answer that question. And I think a lot of front offices right now are trying to figure out exactly what is this free agent market going to look like. You know, we're seeing teams like the Texas Rangers let go of Corey Kluber. You're seeing, you know, teams like the Cleveland Indians who aren't willing to pay Brad Hand, you know, more than $10 million as a back-end reliever. We're going to see a free agent market that I think is going to look drastically different, and just an approach from teams I think looks drastically different, just given, you know, the lack of ticket revenue that teams didn't bring in this year, among so many other things and circumstances that are, you know, affecting the economic circumstances of the game. And so I think it's just a question of, you know, I think we're going to see a really, really weird offseason. I wish I had a crystal ball where I could look and see into the future and just to know exactly what it would look like. But this is just unforeseen. You know, these are unprecedented circumstances, so it's extremely hard to know. But, you know, I think undoubtedly, you know, I think we saw this with Mookie Betts not even deciding to test free agent market in general. You're seeing kind of how we're starting to see the beginnings of how the pandemic is kind of shaping the business of sports, I think, now.
So with that being said, June, this is just your opinion, because I know we can't predict anything, but will we see a very wait-and-see approach by teams and players alike, or do we think that players are just going to kind of take money, even though it might be less than what they thought they were going to get, just to have that contract in hand? Because, like you said, we have no idea what this season's going to look like.
Yeah, I think it's going to be kind of down to the individual, because I'm very interested to see how Trevor Bauer's situation plays out, because he's talked about in the past how he wanted to take one-year deals, sign one-year deals, and kind of operate year to year as kind of a, I guess, kind of with a mercenary Darrell Revis type of mentality. But, you know, just given the circumstances of everything happening right now and the fact that he is a pitcher, and you, who knows what happens with pitchers in their arms, is he going to take a long-term deal? I feel like that by itself, you know, whether we see a deviation from his initial free agency mindset, that is going to be an indicator, I think, in terms of just the larger free agent picture as to how players approach it. But I think it's really going to be a case-by-case situation where, you know, you see players who are going to leap at that job security, the length, and there's going to be people who struggled in this past, you know, this past shortened season, and they're going to try to sign a prove-it deal. You know, I think a guy like Marcell Ozuna, who obviously had an incredible year in Atlanta, you know, it wouldn't be surprising to me if he has to sign another 1 or 2 year deal, just given his age and the position that he plays, and the fact that, you know, despite him being an incredibly good outfielder, there are a lot of outfielders who can, you know, provide at least replacement level value there. So it's going to be very interesting just to see how all of this plays out, because obviously, like, you know, we can conjecture all we want, but it's going to be really, really hard to see until we actually see what teams are willing to put out there. And I think it's going to vary from team to team, like how they're going to approach all this as well.
Let me see if I could pull just one little more piece of conjecture out of you there. The Mets have a new owner, and it feels like there is, if you want, you can go and spend money and basically build yourself a team if you'd like. Did we have any indications of kind of how aggressive they'll be? Obviously, you know, we know if it's just money, Cohen's got more than enough of it to get as aggressive as he wants, but you just laid out all of the factors for the economics of the game. Is there any indication on kind of what direction the Mets are going to take under the new ownership?
Yeah, I mean, as someone who lives in New York and I grew up in Boston, so I'm very familiar with incredibly passionate, you know, do or die kind of fan bases. I would expect, just given the pressure, like, the Mets are expected to win every single year. And I have so many friends from, you know, just life in college and stuff who are Mets fans. And the unbridled optimism that they try to bring to every kind of disaster sinking ship of a Mets season is truly, truly admirable for a fan base. And so I really, really, you know, just for their health and happiness sake, like, I hope that that this, I mean, I think we're inevitably going to see a different management style in terms of just how money is treated, just given the circumstances of the previous owner, the Wilpon Group, and what's going to happen with Steve Cohen. But, you know, it's impossible. He's never owned a sports team before in this context, and so it's kind of impossible to know exactly how exactly he's going to approach managing this in terms of Veda's business, because at the end of the day, these are all businesses, and, you know, these billionaires are looking to make money here in some form or another.
Well said. Talking to June Lee of ESPN, you mentioned growing up in Boston there. Obviously, there's the reports today, the Red Sox talking to Cora again. Are you surprised at all to see them kind of jumping back there? Or did you feel like that was a divorce that kind of neither side wanted to make, but it just had to be done? So it's not too surprising to see them looking at maybe getting back together to extend this terrible relationship metaphor.
Well, I think the circumstances of Alex Cora departing the Red Sox last year, I think there's a lot of really complicated feelings, because, you know, he's a guy who was a former player and had been there for such a long time and was so well respected as a player, and then obviously came in and won a World Series managing the Red Sox, and was, you know, just this immensely popular sports figure in the city of Boston. In a manner that, like, I think is kind of abnormal. Like, really, not since Terry Francona has there been passion behind the manager of the Red Sox in this kind of way. And in many ways, I think Alex Cora exceeded it just because of his personality and his youth and his exuberance. And so, you know, the fact that conversation happens, as if, you know, if it happens as reported, I think it's not surprising, just given the relationship that and the history that Alex Cora has with the Red Sox organization. You know, whether or not that ends up with, you know, Chaim Bloom deciding to hire back Alex Cora, I think, is a whole separate question. But, you know, the fact that they're even talking in the first place, I don't think is at all surprising.
June, in the free agency conversation, Trevor Bauer is, to me, the guy, the main player in all of this. And what kind of opened my eyes was, and we mentioned it, that his willingness to maybe sign a 1 year deal. How many teams does that open up the door for? Because maybe there's a team that's willing to give him $30 million over one season, or $35 million over one season. Do you think more teams would be interested in him on a one-year deal, or less, and they would want to lock him up long-term?
I think Trevor Bauer is an incredibly complicated situation, and each team is going to kind of approach him differently just because he is a polarizing player. And there is, you know, a personality and what some teams would consider baggage that comes alongside signing a player like him. So I don't think it's as simple as he's a great player and teams are just going to, you know, line up to sign him to a one-year deal. I think it's kind of more complicated and nuanced than that. And again, like as I mentioned before, like I think it's going to be interesting to see whether or not Bauer pivots his stance off the one-year deal thing, just given the circumstances of the pandemic and the general uncertainty around the economics and finance of sports as we move forward in the next couple of years, following the kind of the aftermath of the immediate, you know, economic, you know, downturn that we've taken as the United States has taken as a country since the start of the pandemic. So, I think Bauer is just obviously one of the best pitchers in baseball and has shown that he can anchor a high level playoff team rotation. I think there's just so many things up in the air in terms of just regards to how players are going to approach free agency. That's kind of hard to say whether or not he's going to stick to that strategy.
Yeah, there's always a lot of questions with Trevor Bauer, and he'll even answer some of them, and some questions that you aren't answering or asking him. One thing that was kind of, and we'll let you go after this, but one thing that's been kind of bouncing around in my mind is, if it does feel like, you know, salary suppression's a dirty word, let's just say all these teams have exactly the same amount of idea of what players are kind of worth out there. If there's not a lot of difference in salary, do you think we've seen a lot of grousing from players, especially pitchers, not liking this third time through the order and not liking how predetermined it feels like their outings can be? Do you think a team or a front office could kind of separate itself and, you know, for lack of a better term, recruit players by simply saying, we're not going to be as adherent to that. We're still going to take it into account. But I mean, I know here in Toronto, we had a couple of pitchers loudly, openly grousing about being upset coming out. We obviously saw what happened with Snell. Do you think a team could kind of separate itself from others by saying, we're going to go back to a bit of that old school mentality?
I think it's definitely an interesting theory. I mean, I think, just given the, you know, market inefficiencies and the fact that everyone is looking for them nowadays, I think that is definitely one way that teams can market itself to pitchers. And I think it also depends on who the manager in place is. But I think, as much as, like, we want to talk about Blake Snell, getting taken out in Game 6 of the World Series, the Rays used that strategy and it got them to that point in the first place. The Dodgers are built by Andrew Friedman, and Andrew Friedman's disciples basically run the Rays. I mean, it was basically the Andrew Friedman World Series. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of like hot take talking heads talking about like, you know, this is a disgrace to the way baseball has been played. And, you know, I don't necessarily agree with taking out Snell in that situation, just given the fact that he's a Cy Young Award winner. But I do understand the logic from the perspective of Tampa Bay, where you're sticking with your process that has gotten you to that point this late in the season. This is kind of the main cultural tension that is happening within the game right now, where you have the continued evolution of analytics and the fact that we have a lot of like Ivy League, highly educated Wall Street type front offices in baseball right now. All of those things kind of coming together. There's this kind of tension between new school and old school. It's kind of personified in the perceived cultural tension between, you know, people like Tony La Russa and people like the White House clubhouse. So I feel like it just kind of embodies this like new school, old school tension that I think is really coming to the forefront. And then obviously we have a CBA negotiation in the next couple of years that's coming up. That's going to be very, very interesting to watch. So a lot of like very pressing business questions, I think, facing the game right now.
All right, maybe I'll get an MBA in all this downtime we're going to have. Sounds like I might need it. June, really, really enjoyed the chat. Thanks for coming on tonight.
All right, thanks for having me on.
There he goes, June Lee, staff writer from ESPN. Matt, I thought that was kind of interesting. This will shock you. I thought my own question was very, very interesting. about asking him about the idea of teams kind of saying, yeah, we're not going to be slaves to the analytic movement. We're going to allow the game to kind of dictate how it goes. I thought that was interesting. I thought his answer was as well. And you know what? Let's put a pin in that, and we'll talk about it when we continue on Sportsnet tonight.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Just revving up to finish up the final segment of the first hour of Sportsnet tonight. There we go. Almost confused myself. Got it back on the rails. Brent Gunning, Matt Marchese alongside me. Now, Matt, you tweeted out a wonderful poll question earlier tonight. I'm just going to pull up said results of poll question now. No, not the fantasy DFS that you have retweeted. No, not that. Let me scroll past our show lineup here. By the way, head to Matt for all of your fantasy sports insights that you need. What's the scariest thing for a Toronto sports fan at Fan590, Leafs, Raptors, Blue Jays? Is it a long-term Matthews injury, a long-term Lowry injury, Game 7 versus the Bruins, or any series at the Trop? Still eking out a lead right now with 48% of the votes, any Game 7 versus the Bruins. Not at all surprised to see the Leafs are leading. Matt, I'm going to throw another. This is more of a saddest thing than a scariest thing, and it's kind of to do with the second option on your poll. You say a long-term Kyle Lowry injury would be scary. How about this? It's entirely possible we have seen the bulk of that Raptors championship team play its last game in Toronto as a Raptor. How about that?
Yeah, it's so true. I don't anticipate that Marc Gasol is going to be back. I think there's a chance that Serge Ibaka's back. I think that makes a little bit of sense. There's a chance that Fred VanVleet's not back because the Raptors may not, you know, adhere to his contractual demands. I hope that they would, but I'm not so sure that's. I don't think it's a slam dunk. Pardon the pun. So yeah, it's really interesting how that last year could be the kind of swan song for that group.
Well, and even let's go a little bit further again. Like we've seen all the reports of the Raptors, or well, not so much the Raptors looking, but other cities are recruiting the Raptors, saying, hey, we'd love to host you here. You know, who knows where they will play home games this year? And you know, I'm not going to sit here and pretend I know when this whole COVID thing is going to be over. I mean, it's entirely possible the Raptors don't play a home game in Toronto at Scotiabank next season. And then, you know, you start to run into a point of, well, where's Kyle Lowry a couple seasons from now? And, you know, I don't think anybody wants to go there, but it's like, that is something I keep thinking about, is how Danny Green has yet to get his Raptors ring because he wants to get it in front of fans in Toronto. Careful what you wish for, Danny. But the fact of the matter is, it's entirely possible that you're not going to get a chance to kind of have that moment for this core again, that you know, take Kyle Lowry out one last time, let the fans give it to him. It's really more sad than scary for me.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And again, we don't, like you said, we don't know what next year is going to hold. The Raptors may not be playing in Toronto. There's a real good chance that they don't get to give Kyle Lowry that proper send-off. But I have a sneaky suspicion that Kyle Lowry is going to retire a Raptor as long as Masai Ujiri is still here.
And that leads us right into what somebody else suggested as the scariest thing in Toronto sports, and that's Masai Ujiri not re-signing. I don't think there is any doubt. I think the only real argument that can be made for any person who means more to any franchise in this city is Austin Matthews and Masai Ujiri. Like, I don't know that there's a single athlete other than Austin Matthews. I don't know that there's an athlete that can kind of put himself on that stratosphere, because you look at John Tavares. Yes, he means a lot to the Leafs, but Austin Matthews is right there, and Tavares is already kind of at his peak, exiting his peak. You look at the Raptors. Yes, Kyle Lowry means a lot, but I think we'd all say you can only have one going forward. We'll take Masai, please. Like, there's definitely not a Blue Jay that's in that stratosphere. It feels to me like Masai, his place as an executive is, we think about it a lot. We think about how respected he is in this market, but when you actually put it in terms of valuable assets, I don't know that there's an athlete aside from Matthews that's more valuable to their franchise than Masai is.
You're not a big fan of Alejandro Pozuelo? Like, come on, Brent. No, I think that's a very accurate assessment. When you look at what Masai Ujiri has done, and it's not all on Masai Ujiri, because the team still has to play the games and the players have to, you know, prove on the court that they are something. But Masai Ujiri has made Toronto a destination. Whether or not players want to come here via free agency, when players do get here, whether it is free agency, drafted, or they get traded for, they really fall in love with not only the city, but the organization and what the organization does. And I would say 90% of that is on Masai Ujiri, bringing in the people that he's brought in. He's taken some chances. He's taken some big risks. He fired the coach of the year and brought in another guy. Like, how many people do that and then win a championship the next year? Yeah, they had some help because, you know, he also made a huge trade, traded, you know, one of the most popular players in franchise history and one of the best for a superstar. The trade worked out absolutely amazing for him. So people around the league recognize that. And I really wonder, even though they didn't have a lot of success in the bubble, or at least success, not the success that we expected, I wonder how many of the players took notice of the Raptors and what they do and how they operate and all that kind of stuff. Because, you know, with the Black Lives Matter bus and that kind of stuff, I think players really take notice of, and I wonder how much that has to, like, I wonder how much players will look at that and go, I want to go there. I don't care about crossing the border, you know, and maybe, and I know this is, you know, wading into waters that we probably don't want to get too much into, but I wonder how much the results of this election, the American election, will have an effect on people wanting to maybe come to Toronto to play professional sports.
Well, careful what you wish for, Matt, because I'm super comfortable in those waters. I've got my bathing suit on. I'm floating around in the jacuzzi.
Do you have water wings on?
No, I don't need them. Like, I'm just that comfortable in the water. And I should probably remind everyone out there listening, and I'm going to tell you, I don't know if you've put this together yet, me and you will be on the air during the U.S. election on Tuesday, right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Oh, so, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You better believe that topic will be getting peppered in, mostly sports, but that'll be the seasoning, is the way I'd like to put it. Now, quickly, I did want to get into, again, this tremendous point I made to our baseball guest, June Lee of ESPN. I do wonder if a team, we know it's not going to be the Blue Jays, but I do wonder if it's a team that somebody out there could use the idea of, we're going to make the way we handle our pitchers be the new market inefficiency. You're upset that you can't go a third time through the order? Not here in, I don't know, Oakland, for example. Like, I do wonder if especially in a year where it doesn't seem like there's going to be a lot of money floating around out there, Trevor Bowers said he wants to pitch every 4 days. I wonder if some team says to him, okay, you know what, Trevor? You can go every fourth day. We're going to handle other people in other ways, but you can go every fourth day. I wonder if that could be a, you know, for lack of a better term, a tiebreaker for some free agents.
It's really interesting because I actually wondered if the Rays winning would have been bad for baseball.
It
because,
would.
Like, if Blake Snell gets pulled, despite being absolutely electric, and they somehow go on and win Game 6, and then they go out and win Game 7, I just wonder what the long-term effects of that is for the game of baseball, which already has a hard time in marketing their stars and getting people younger than 55 years old out to ballparks or watching on TV. I really do think that some teams are at least going to try that avenue, because not everybody is 100% on board. And I don't mean they're not on board, but they don't live and die by the analytics. And there are some teams that do that. To be honest with you, I think the Jays are 95% live and die by analytics. Based on some of the lineup decisions that we've seen over the course of this season, I don't think that that's on Charlie Montoyo. I think a lot of that is coming from up top. So having said that, I do think that there are teams that will try and use that to their advantage. I think that it's an excellent point, because at this point, Brent, if you think that that's going to be the deal breaker for you to get a superstar, why wouldn't you do it?
Like, honestly, talent is what wins games. You can be smart about how to use it, but I'd rather have the guy there to be used. And then, hey, who knows, depending on whatever promises are made, maybe once they get into your system and they see your way of doing things, there's some kind of happy medium to be found. I'm sure there are plenty of Blue Jays who would have loved to have found that medium with Chuck Montoyo at some point this year. Didn't exactly happen. We're going to dive back into baseball a little later on here on Sportsnet tonight. Caitlin McGrath, a staff writer for The Athletic, will join us, tee up what the Blue Jays might have in store for this offseason. Hopefully they're busy. Hopefully adding pitchers. At least that's what I would like to see. But coming up next hour, lots of football. We'll talk a little Bills a little later on in the 8 o'clock hour. But next, we'll have Torrey Gurley, a former NFL wide receiver and analyst, joining us next on Sportsnet tonight.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Sports fans live in the moment. There's only tonight. Game night. Welcome to Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet tonight, continuing into the second hour of the program. Matt Marchese and me, Brent Gunning, will be here with you until 11 o'clock tonight. Obviously, plenty to get into in the NFL, and joining us now to discuss exactly that, Torrey Gurley, former NFL wide receiver, current NFL analyst. Torrey, how are you doing tonight?
I'm good. How are you guys doing?
Doing well. Always happy whenever we get to discuss the NFL. So let's get right into it. So the one question I'm having, or I guess problem I'm having so far into the season, is normally at this point in time, it feels like there's been one or two teams, maybe three, maybe four, that have really kind of started to separate themselves atop the kind of pecking order in the league. And it feels like usually there's a mushy middle, but this year it feels like there's a mushy top. Obviously, no, we know the Steelers are unbeaten, but then you look at those other teams at kind of 5-1 or 5-2, and I'm just not really sold on any of them being a kind of truly elite team. Has any team kind of jumped out and separated itself for you so far?
Of course, the Kansas City Chiefs and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Kansas City has reloaded. They've only lost one game. And obviously, that, you know, it's one of those letdown games that you have when you're used to just overpowering a division. And then the Buccaneers, they had a strong showing over the past few weeks on primetime spots. And Tom Brady has those guys ready to roll. They once upon a time was the most penalized team in the NFL, and now these guys are almost playing mistake-free. The defense never gets enough credit, but Todd Bowles and that Bucs defense is getting after these opposing quarterbacks. And, you know, I think it's a two-team race right now for the Super Bowl.
Yeah, the Buccaneers are interesting, because I agree. I think that defense is getting completely overlooked because everybody wants to look at the offense, and why wouldn't you with all the stars there? The question I have about Brady is, it feels like, and we've been seeing this for the past, I don't know, two, three seasons, it feels like now, where he will kind of fluctuate between, at points in times, looking like he has completely lost his rhythm, completely lost his touch, and then he will kind of fluctuate back to being, you know, the GOAT that we've seen throughout his entire career. Do you have any worry at all about kind of trusting what you get week to week out of Tom Brady?
You know, I would say that if he was in New England, but now the way the Tampa Bay Buccaneers has constructed a team around him, he has so much talent on offense where he doesn't have to do the heavy lifting anymore. He literally can hand the ball off to Ronald Jones. He can hand it off to Leonard Fournette, or whenever in doubt, he has his security blanket and Gronk, and he still has those players on the perimeter, and Antonio Brown, Mike Evans, and Chris Godwin. So in New England, as you can see with Cam Newton, that cupboard is pretty bare, and Tom literally had to carry that team. And now with him being in Tampa, I think he can really pace himself to go on a nice playoff run towards the end of the year.
Torrey, The one thing for me that's been really surprising this year, especially because there wasn't a training camp and these guys didn't have a lot of chance to learn, and I guess their true talent is coming through, is how good the rookie quarterbacks have played. Joe Burrow and Justin Herbert, and I actually think Herbert has been even more impressive than Burrow, considering the circumstances in which he came into the game. What has your take been so far on them, and what do you expect out of Tua this week in his first start against the Rams?
I think it's one of those situations where you sink or swim, because when you don't know, you don't know. So these guys are out here freely playing, and it's just a testament to the hard work of them as individuals. But there's a thing in the NFL called a rookie wall, and eventually these guys are going to hit it. Obviously, we're starting to get into the meat of the schedule, and that's your division games. And these teams have accumulated enough film on these rookie guys to know exactly what makes them uncomfortable. And I think we're going to start to see some of these younger players struggle coming down the stretch, because now it's something they're just not acclimated to, and it's going to take a couple years to get it. But as a football fan, I'm extremely happy, because these guys have a tremendous future ahead of them. And to answer your second question about Tua, I think I think he's going to struggle on Sunday. You mentioned earlier there's no OTAs, there was no training camp, and he got no preseason reps. I don't expect him to come out here and play well against the LA Rams at 1 o'clock at home. I think he's going to look like a rookie. And the Dolphins are okay with that, because, you know, they spent a first-round pick on him. So I think he's just going to have his growing pains, and we all watch it on TV on Sunday coming up.
Now, I know we should be talking about the better teams in the league, but I just, after hearing that answer, the thing that popped into my head is, okay, so what do we make of Sam Darnold then, of how he started his career? Because obviously it's not looked good. Anytime you're seen on the sidelines going, I'm seeing ghosts, it's a terrible side for the start of your NFL career. But we've also seen now a guy in Ryan Tannehill who is freed from the gay shackles, and he looks like he's kind of found himself. I don't think anyone thinks he's some MVP superstar player, but he's definitely a capable NFL quarterback. When you see a guy like Darnold who's been kind of stuck in that Jet scenario, and how well all of these other rookies have played in, you know, varying degree of lengthiness of their stints. But do you think at all that, you know, Darnold has what it takes, or is he, and he's just kind of being held back by Gase, or do you worry at all about his kind of NFL future beyond this year?
No, being in the right team is everything. Wherever you get drafted to or whoever signs you, it matters. And it shows in, with the New York Jets that they're a dysfunctional bunch. I mean, you let go of Jamal Adams for nothing, and you let go of so many players, and now you have Sam Darnold. Like, God bless him. I mean, he's out there throwing to guys that we don't even know of. Like, we have to go Google his receivers on the spot, especially if you're playing fantasy. So my heart goes out to him, because he's a guy that he just wants to compete, and he wants to be surrounded by talent, and I'm hoping that they can find a way to get him out of there and you put him in a better situation. Like, if he gets, it wouldn't shock me if he gets traded this week, since the trade deadline is coming up. And, you know, everyone wants to tank for Trevor Lawrence. Well, if I'm the Indianapolis Colts, or if I'm a team that's in the middle of the pack that needs a quarterback, man, if you get Sam Darnold at the trade deadline, now you don't have to worry about Phillip Rivers. So it truly matters. And, you know, if you take Tom Brady and put him with the Cleveland Browns, as great as Tom Brady is, he's not going to be able to turn around that organization. And that's how I feel about the Jets. And, you know, I'm just hoping that it works out for Sam Darnold and they get rid of Adam Gase, because if not, man, this guy's going to continue to run this quarterback's career in the ground.
As I said in one of my fantasy articles from a couple weeks ago, Adam Gase to the fantasy community is like jorts to the fashion world. It's just not a good look. The one thing about Gase is I've just never understood how he keeps getting these jobs. I get he had one good stint as the offensive coordinator with Peyton Manning, but that was with Peyton Manning. Is there any way to explain how he goes from doing a really poor job, and we've seen how good Ryan Tannehill actually is, being away from Adam Gase, and so many other players have followed suit, and then he gets that job and then goes to New York where he gets another job. Why does this keep happening?
Peyton Manning. You know, I think Tom Brady and Peyton Manning have got a lot of people paid, from players to folks in the front office, where they can just ride their coattails and say, hey, I brought them in, or I scouted them, or I coached them. And a lot of these teams, instead of doing their homework, they just kind of take that at face value and believe that they can turn, have that same type of, goodwill, or that same type of production on their current team. And it just doesn't work that way. There isn't such thing as a cookie cutter type of coaching. So, I just wish this guy stopped getting head coaching jobs, because there are some great candidates out there that would love to get their hands on a player like Sam Darnold and mold him into, you know, a franchise quarterback.
Well, you talk about Tom Brady making coordinators look good, and Josh McDaniels is looking around going, oh, maybe I should have taken one of those head coaching gigs, because this year it's not looking nearly as good. One offensive coordinator who has definitely been getting talked up, if there were any openings, is Brian Daboll with the Bills. What have you made of them? Obviously, they had the great start to the season. They were able to win last week, but boy, it was not impressive at all against the Jets. Where are you on we know the defense has had its own struggles, but let's stick with the offense there in Buffalo. What do you make of what the Bills have going on there, and are you convinced Josh Allen is good enough to lead them to the playoffs and maybe even make a run?
Well, just being a part of the Buffalo family, Bills Mafia, and knowing a lot of guys in that locker room, COVID has really affected them, because they truly have a home field advantage. And Buffalo and Green Bay and these small city teams, the city really rallies around those guys on game day. Like, it's one of the toughest places to play. And with the governor of New York shutting down live sports and saying that you can't have a crowd, that truly affects them, because defensively, that's how they get after people. They try to get you in third and long, and they allow their premier pass rushers like Justin Hughes or other guys you have on a defensive line that can just get after you, and that crowd means the world to them. And I think that's going to be Buffalo's Achilles heel this year, is they finally got a great team, finally have the right personnel, but that cherry on top is that home field advantage, and that's just something they don't have. And they're starting to struggle on defense, because they really can't stop anyone. And offense, I think the quarterback is doing a great job, Josh Allen. Brian Daboll has really like called up some plays to where they're playing to his strength. And with the addition of Stephon Diggs on a perimeter, he gets his shots downfield. And I just think last week, there is such thing in the NFL as guys playing up and playing down to their competition. And that's what they did. They knew they could beat the Jets, eyes closed, and they went out there and put up that type of performance. But I think this week, going against the New England Patriots, these guys will be locked in, because New England has ran that division for the past 18 years. So now it's Buffalo's chance to go out there and be top dog in the AFC East.
You went from one thing near and dear to my heart, and that's the Buffalo Bills, and we'll talk about something else that's near and dear to my heart. And fantasy football has become all the rage now. You get people that I know people that don't even watch football that play fantasy football, and they're like stock market guys. It's crazy how the world has changed. But one player I wanted to focus on is Antonio Brown. He only played one game with Tom Brady last year, and it was like the greatest thing that ever happened to Tom Brady, apparently, because he wants to bring him everywhere he goes now. So how do you think, from a fantasy perspective, that Antonio Brown fits into that offense, especially with all the injuries that they have to wide receivers?
I think it's going to be a great addition. And on top of that, something that most fans or fantasy owners don't understand or know is that a lot of these guys are going into a locker room and they've never experienced that playbook. And it takes a lot of time to really focus on and learn. But now Antonio Brown, he has a rapport with Bruce Arians. So when he goes in there, he's going to be ready to roll. He's going to be ready to play, because he's been in that offense in Pittsburgh. And obviously, when you have Tom Brady lobbying for you, you're in a situation where you don't want to let him down. And I just think it's going to be a great pickup, where he's going to go out there And I'm not going to say he's going to be a world beater, but this guy's going to be a great addition, and he's going to be hard to defend because you still have Mike Evans on the perimeter as well as Chris Godwin, and you have Gronk that's in the middle of the field. So if Antonio Brown can run just enough and get separation, man, this guy, he's going to be hard to bring down in the open field with one-on-ones.
All right, Torrey. I was a big Michael Gallup fan heading into this season, and I really thought that things were going to play out very well for that whole offense, and they were at the beginning, but now we have Ben DiNucci starting at quarterback, and even with Andy Dalton and that banged-up offensive line, can you really trust any of the Dallas Cowboys from a fantasy perspective at this point?
No, you can have Randy Moss and Jerry Rice at receiver on your fantasy team, but the two most important people for the Cowboys that are injured are their tackles. Lael Collins and Tyron Smith, those guys have been hampered with injuries throughout the year. And like I said, I don't care who you have at receiver. If you don't have an offensive line that can protect, and if you don't have a quarterback that's confident, the guy, that wide receiver is not going to get the ball. You can sit there and wish and hope and scream at your phone or at your laptop or whatever type of device you have to have your fantasy roster. But the meat and potatoes, the game is won up front with the offensive line. And when you don't have that, you're just not going to be able to get any production from your skill players. So anyone – hear me out. Anyone that has a Dallas player, I would literally try to trade them or I would just cut them because you're not going to get that same type of production with Dak Prescott being gone and their key offensive lineman. Literally, when you have your both tackles, these guys are the second and third highest paid players on the team because they protect the most important person on the team is the quarterback. And whenever you don't have that, you're just not going to be successful. And that's why Dallas is they can't get out of their own way.
Yeah, both tackles are hurt, and you're up to your third-string quarterback. But, I mean, other than that, it's going great in Big D. Hopefully we have a big weekend of games here. You'll be able to listen to Bills and Patriots here starting at 12:30 on Sunday on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Torrey, thanks so much for the time tonight. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you for having me. And if anyone have any additional fantasy questions, reach out to me on my social media at tgurley81 as well as listen to my podcast, Champions Club. It's streaming on all major platforms. Hit me up. I help you win that fantasy league so you can brag to all your friends.
There we go. Look at that. Public service announcement at the very end. There he goes. Torrey Gurley, former NFL wide receiver. Thoroughly enjoyed the chat with him. So, Matt, obviously, we got a little fantasy plays there. I do want to jump back into the Bills. We talked about it off the top, but it feels like this is a, you know, I'm sure there are people rolling their eyes at this, but sometimes it's true. This has to be a statement game. It has to be a statement win. They have been toiling in this division for basically my entire adult life, and this is a chance to just stomp their foot down, eliminate the Patriots from any contention in it, and kind of get their season back on track. It feels so much more important than your average Week 8 game.
Well, it is, because if they can win this game, that'll give them, I believe, a 4-game lead in the division over the Patriots, and depending on what happens Sunday, my guess is that the Dolphins lose to the Rams, that it'll give them a 3-game lead on the Dolphins. So, in terms of the rest of the schedule, this is a big game because the rest of the schedule is not easy for the Bills. They get to play Seattle. They get to play San Francisco. They get to play the Chargers, who I still think are a tough team. The Cardinals. They get to play the Steelers. They get the Patriots and Dolphins again this year. So it's not as if the schedule gets any easier after this game. So you have to take your wins where you can get them if you're the Bills, because you don't know where they're going to come after that. I think that they have a chance to beat the Seahawks. I think that they have a chance to beat the Cardinals. The Chargers, sure. You know, do they have a chance to beat the Niners? Yeah. The Steelers, I think, are a much better team. Like, there's a lot of iffy games. There's no game on that schedule that you look at and go, yeah, you know what? That's an easy win for the Bills. They don't have those anymore. Even the Broncos. I think the Bills are better than the Broncos, but they're certainly not an easy out for them, especially if the Bills can't run the ball, because if they don't start running the ball, I don't know what's going to happen. They invested, you know, some high picks in Devin Singletary and Zach Moss, and I don't know what happened to Devin Singletary, but it is not working for him this year.
Yeah, the run game just hasn't been good at all. I mean, I know the offensive line's been banged up, so that's going to be part of it. But yeah, it's absolutely crucial that they take care of business this week, and I think there's really no reason to not expect them to do that. You mentioned one game coming up in a couple of weeks' time on the Bills' schedule. There is the Chargers, and I just wanted to get a quick thought from you on Justin Herbert, because I don't know that there's a young quarterback in this league who's surprised me more. Everything I was reading about this guy is, well, quiet, da-da-da, and then he gets thrusted into the starting position after Tyrod Taylor gets stabbed in the lung, like one of the crazier outcomes you could have to have a guy start his NFL career, and he's been more or less nailed since he started. Are you surprised at how good he's looked early in his career?
Not, I guess, yes, I am, and I'll say it because of this. There were a lot of reports out of training camp that he was not ready. And I don't know how much of that was coach speak, but, you know, there's always the worry that rookie quarterbacks are going to come in and they're going to struggle. But the one thing about Justin Herbert was, and people do forget this, that if Justin Herbert had come out the year before this year, so last season, if he had come out for the NFL draft, that Justin Herbert would have been the first QB taken overall. It wouldn't have been anyone else. Justin Herbert was the guy. So he goes back one more year and doesn't necessarily have a great season, but good enough that he becomes, you know, a top 10 pick in the NFL draft. But behind Joe Burrow, who had a miraculous college football season, probably the best ever. And that's just what happened. And Tua goes ahead of him because Tua had this, you know, this long resume at Alabama and national championship and all this kind of stuff. So that's the reason why Justin Herbert fell. But let's not forget that he has the ability. He has a skill set that not a lot of guys have. He's a big guy who can run the ball very well, and he's got a cannon for an arm, and he can throw a great deep ball. There's, like, that kind of package doesn't really exist. Oh, and he's smart. So I'm not
until you said the last thing, it sounded exactly like the Bills guy. Oh,
yes, I know. And actually, Herbert reminded me a little bit more of Carson Wentz early in his career as opposed to what Carson Wentz is now. But I digress. It's just really interesting the evolution of the rookie quarterback over just the course of the first 6-7 games of the season. I really didn't expect them both to be this good, and really curious to see what Tua looks like out of the gate on Sunday, because that is certainly not the easiest matchup to make your debut in. And honestly, Brent, like, did the Chargers not, I know this is really bad to say, but did they not luck out to finding out how good Justin Herbert was by, like you said, a freak thing that happened where they wrongfully injected Tyrod Taylor?
Yeah, it was a complete luck, and you know, sometimes you take advantage of the breaks, and I think that's exactly what's happening with the Chargers there. Well, we're going to take advantage of that's Dan Fates, a sports anchor and reporter with 13 WHAM Sports in Buffalo. He'll join us next, dive more into the Bills, because yeah, it's a big weekend in Buffalo. We'll have the Bills and Patriots for you on Sunday. When we continue here on Sportsnet tonight, we'll preview that matchup. It's next.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Do not settle. Demand. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Tonight, Brent Gunning, Matt Marchese alongside me. We'll be here with you until 11 o'clock. Right now, we're getting you ready for a busy weekend in the NFL. No busier than between the Bills and the Patriots. Obviously, that game has been circled on the calendar for many of people. We've had it circled on the calendar because you'll be able to hear it right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, starting with the pregame at 12:30. Game gets going just after 1 o'clock. Joining us now to tee up the Bills' big weekend is Dan Fates, a sports anchor and reporter with 13 WHAM Sports. Dan, thanks so much for the time tonight.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, guys.
So let's jump right into it. I mean, obviously, this Bills team got off to about as good of a start as you could have possibly asked for, and then since then, it's kind of gone the exact opposite. If I were to ask you which of those teams is more true to the Buffalo, what the Bills actually are, is it the team we've seen the past couple of weeks or the one that started out 4-0?
I think it's more of the team that started out 4-0. Look, teams have made an adjustment on the Bills. I compared it to a baseball player that comes up as a rookie and hits 7 home runs in his first week of the season, and then teams realize, well, that guy can hit a fastball. Let's start throwing him some off-speed pitches. And look, the Bills' 2 losses were to Kansas City and to Tennessee, the 2 teams that played in the AFC Championship game last year. And they were also weird circumstances. I know this whole season has been weird, but they were a Monday night and a Tuesday night. Look, the Bills just didn't show up. But they started to play better last week against the Jets, albeit the Jets, the defense started to show signs of life for the first time this season. They held New York to 4 yards of offense in the second half. And while they didn't get in the end zone, Josh Allen showed maturity. Look, he has talked about how he's a gunslinger and how he always wants touchdowns first, but Josh showed maturity and patience of taking the underneath route. He finished, he only threw about 10 yards past the line, over 10 yards down the line, down the field. And he talked about how it was exactly what they gave him. Teams are now adjusting to what the Bills are doing, and he still finished with 300 yards and a win. If you would have told anybody that last year that Josh Allen threw for 300 yards and the Bills win, they would have thought he was great, and Josh was average last week. So that's a positive sign.
Dan, the one thing that I did see on Twitter over the past couple weeks is the Bills are undefeated in games that they play on their regularly scheduled day. So we can take that for what it is. But, you mentioned that teams are not allowing the Bills much offensively, and you're talking about those 10-yard throws downfield. How much of that is due to the fact that they haven't had John Brown basically for the last 3 weeks?
I think that's a huge point, and I think that's something that we've been trying to address. Look, we know on the defensive side of the ball, Trey White is the most talented player on the Bills' defense. But I think that Matt Milano is the most important player on the Bills' defense. And when you look at the Bills' offense, obviously Josh Allen is the most talented. Stephon Diggs is the true number one wide receiver. But John Brown may be the most important piece to the Bills' offense and what they can do. And look, he just hasn't been right. I was at practice on Wednesday. He looked about 50%, but he was not on the injury report this week. So that's a good sign. And he's just one of those guys, and Stephon Diggs has praised how underappreciated he is, how underrespected he is in this league, and how talented he is and what he means to this team. And over these last few weeks, we've seen him try to gut out through a calf injury and a knee injury, something that's been lingering with him. He looks to be a full go this week, and I think that's a big game changer to this offense to get him back on the field, because not only that, it just teams have been able to kind of focus in on Stephon Diggs the last 2 weeks. That's why we saw Cole Beasley have 11 catches underneath last week. That was a career high for him. Adding John Brown back into this offense, I think, gets them back into that, not necessarily 30 points a game against New England, but definitely gets them back towards the end zone again.
Yeah, I think Brown is going to have a massive impact on this. He just helps kind of take the top off the defense. I do wonder if, I was looking at some of the numbers for Allen on, attempts of more than 15 yards through the air, and he's really hit a wall in that regards. I do wonder how much of that is simply just the lack of protection. Obviously, we know the line hasn't been what it is, and that's going to affect the run game, but obviously it would have to impact how much time Allen has back there. Have you noticed much of a difference there in terms of him kind of having less time the past couple of weeks?
It seems like he's had enough time. It's just the way that defenses are playing him. They're really taking away the deep shot. They're playing these cover 2 zone defenses, especially the Jets. They were dropping 7-8 guys, 10 yards deep, and that's why Josh took so many balls underneath to Cole Beasley. So I think it's more of just, it's so funny to see Josh. He was visibly upset and almost sick with himself, the fact that he had to check the ball down so many times last week. And he threw for 300 yards. Like, any other time, he would have loved it. But teams have really adjusted. And, last year, Josh couldn't have had the game he had on Sunday. He wouldn't have had the patience or the discipline to take the checkdowns. And look, it was a very dink-and-dunk offense for the Bills last week. And then, obviously, they stalled in the red zone with a couple bad penalties, illegal formations, a couple holding calls that really stalled out drives. But, they still had over 350 yards of offense. Josh, again, threw for 300 yards. It's just this adjustment that teams don't want to get beat over the top, because we saw the first few weeks of the season that Stephon Diggs and John Brown were getting behind defenses. And that was something that Josh struggled in last year, of completing those deep balls. Well, he showed in the first 4 weeks of the season that he can connect on them again, and teams have had to adjust. So it's this cat and mouse game that Josh is trying to do. But I think this offense is built to give some chunk plays, but they've learned and they showed last week that they could do 10, 11, 12 play drives and still get points on the board.
So, Dan, you talked about the penalties, and the one thing that we hadn't seen in the first four games was this team take a lot of them, whether on the offensive side of the ball or the defensive side of the ball. What we have seen over the last 3 weeks is a lot of dumb penalties and very un-Buffalo Bills, like a Jordan Poyer throwing a guy out of bounds. And the Tre'Davious White making a stupid hit outside the lines. Like, that is a very un-Sean McDermott-like team that was playing those weeks. It almost had me harken back to the Rex Ryan days. Like, that's how undisciplined they look. Are you expecting that to change now over the next few games? Because they really need wins over the next couple weeks.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. The Poyer and White unnecessary roughness calls. The guy wasn't just necessarily over the line. He was in the bench when they were getting tackled. And it did bring back the Rex Ryan days. And that was frustration. And it was clear as day that the defense that had been the cornerstone of this franchise for the last, especially the last 3 years, going back before Rex, you could almost say for the last two decades, the offense hasn't been the identity of this franchise. It's been the defense, and the defense had been getting torched, giving up over 27 points per game, where they gave up 16 last year. Look, defenses across the board this year, we have seen offenses have the advantage, whether that's crowd noise or whatever. But I thought that was a lot of frustration, and I always remember Micah Hyde said last year when the Bills started out 3-0, we were in the locker room, we were talking to him, and he said that confidence is a hell of a drug. And I thought that was something that's always stuck with me. And albeit what the Bills did last week was against the worst offense, maybe the worst coach in the league, and the worst offense and the worst team in the New York Jets, they started to get that confidence again. The Bills had 6 sacks last week against Sam Darnold and the Jets, something they hadn't done. And just the thought of them going, we only allowed 4 points. It was still a 1-score game with a minute left when Jerry Hughes came up with a sack, a strip sack, and an interception. Like, that was one of those things that when they talked this week, they didn't care that it was the Jets. They thought they got a little bit of that swagger back. And I just look at it as maybe it's just a little bit of that confidence back. You know, they really kind of had their tail between their legs, getting thumped by Tennessee, getting bullied around on the ground by Kansas City. And I thought for the first half against the Jets, they looked soft again. Jerry Hughes said they were challenged by the coaching staff at halftime to really step up, and they did. So I thought that, albeit it has to be taken with a grain of salt, just the confidence of what they built in the second half last week hopefully will propel this team to go up against a very wounded Patriots offense that isn't much better than what the Jets has been playing as of late.
Okay, you said maybe the worst coach in football. I don't think there's a maybe there. I don't even think we need an asterisk. I think you got it right. But you mentioned the defense and what they've been playing like. A couple things here. A, what do they need to do to improve? Because the run defense has been a real problem. And B, do you think they were in on the Carlos Dunlap conversation? Because that would have been a guy that they could really use on the defensive line.
Yeah, the Carlos Dunlap thing is interesting just because I don't know how the money and the salary crap would have worked out. And I know a lot of teams, and I've talked to a bunch of people around the league, they're worried about what the salary cap could be like next year. Also, it is a 5 to 6 day COVID testing period to get somebody in. So this is going to be an even weirder trade deadline as we've started to see the NFL not necessarily get to the MLB like or NBA like, but you started to see much more trades in the recent years in the NFL. I don't know if we'll see that as much. I would have liked to see them being on a pass rusher because you wanted to talk about the defense. The running defense has been poor. They've really missed that one technique nose tackle that when Star Lotulelei opted out, Harrison Phillips has been a healthy scratch the last 2 weeks inside. They've gone with Justin Zimmer. And I constantly have to ask myself, who is Justin Zimmer? They've gone with him over Harrison Phillips. So it's been a revolving door. I constantly am constantly looking for them to try and find a nose tackle or even a quarterback at this trade deadline. Look, they've been decimated. Josh Norman's not going to play this week. Levi Wallace has been injured throughout. Trey White's been dealing with lingering back issues. So I think that if the Bills needed to do something, they need a pass rusher because they just haven't been getting to the quarterback. And while the fans and everybody wants to go, well, they need to blitz more. The Bills have blitzed the 6th most in the NFL this season. They're just not getting there. And that's a recipe for a disaster when you're sending more guys and you're not getting there. And you also are missing your 2nd and 3rd best corner. So It's not a miracle fix that this Bills defense is going to get, even at the trade deadline, but I think a pass rusher could be, you know, something they could use. And it's funny because there's been word that Trent Murphy has possibly been on the trading block. And we were talking to, you know, my colleagues this week, and I go, if Trent Murphy was on the trading block, the Bills would be interested in a guy like Trent Murphy. And they said he was a healthy scratch in Buffalo 2 weeks ago. So they're trying to find anything they can to get some pass rush. They found it last week with Jerry Hughes being the AFC player, defensive player of the week. So you hope that that continues to build.
All right. I had to do a little bit of math, and by math I mean I had to Google it because I'm certainly not very good at math. But I read that there could be winds up to, and it was like 54 kilometers per hour. So carry the one, time multiply that by six is 33 miles per hour. Do you anticipate that there will be a lot of design Josh Allen runs, and is this the game that the run game can finally get right?
Yeah, if there's ever a game where they can get right, you're exactly right. It's got to be this one. It's supposed to be nasty. It's supposed to be heavy rain, heavy winds. We talked to some of the players today about it. We asked Zach Moss if he'd ever played in a game like that, and he kind of laughed. He's a Utah guy and said, I've played in games with heavy wind, and I've played in games with heavy rain. I've never done it at the same time. So we were even kind of joking around of, do you think what's going to be higher, the point total or the highest wind gust? Because it could get up to 40 miles per hour. I don't know if right now I saw yesterday the total was 41.5. That seemed awfully high for me, especially for two offenses that, you know, just aren't clicking right now. And the Patriots, you know, really got bullied on the ground last week by the 49ers at home. Now, obviously, people wanted to go, well, if there was ever a game to get a running game going against, it would have been against Tennessee or Kansas City, and the Bills weren't able to do that. I expect Josh Allen to once again probably be the team's leading rusher, but this is going to be a game where feature heavily Cole Beasley and just kind of an ugly game. Look, after they beat the Jets, I don't think anybody felt great about it, and we were asking Josh Allen about it after the game. And he ran out of cliches, and he was just like, well, it's a division game. You know, they're all ugly, and, you know, a win's a win, and we'll take them. And he kept getting asked, like, two or three questions in a row, and he ended up one of his answers was, yeah, it is what it is. Like, it's a win. And I just thought that was so perfectly said, and I think that we want the Bills to come out and flex their muscle against a Patriots team that just seems to be in disarray. For the first time in two decades, whether they're going to have a fire sale and, you know, Julian Edelman's out and Stephon Gilmore, I don't think the Bills care about a 10-point or a 20-point win. They just want to win. And if it has to be 13-12 or 8-6, they'll take it and they will be celebrating at one Bills drive. So ugly, expect an ugly game. I like the under for those people that care. And especially for what the injury report is, both teams have seven guys listed as questionable. This is going game. Let's just leave it at that. But I like the Bills in this one because if they don't win this game, this is just a mental hurdle that the Bills need to get over. Tom Brady's not there. This is not a Patriot team that we have seen like. They just don't look like themselves. And you kind of have to look past the colors of the jerseys because that's all that we're used to seeing with New England right now.
Okay, 40.5. 40.5 is the total. I just saw it.
It's dropping.
Yeah, it's dropping and the wind's not. So you might be right. It might be the highest miles per hour on the wind gust that beats the total on Sunday.
Yeah, it's going to be ugly.
Yeah, it is. Almost like that transition there. But we're all professional broadcasters. We'll clean it all up. Dan Fates, thanks so much for joining us tonight, and enjoy the game on Sunday.
Yeah, I appreciate it, guys. Thanks for having me on.
There he goes, Dan Fates, sports anchor and reporter with 13 Wham Sports. If you listen to him, sounds like a lot of people dressing up as the ghost of Al Davis tomorrow in Buffalo. Just win, baby, please. Just win. For me, I'd like a little more than just a win. I know it's the magic of the Patriots and all that. For me, I understand everything he's saying of a division game. Hey, you want to get back on track. No, what you'd like to do is actually get back on track to being the good team you were supposed to be, not just squeaking by middling teams within your division. That's all I end up at is it's nice to say just get the win, but no, actually, you know, show everyone that you are far and away the better than at least the two worst teams in that division.
Well, that's exactly it. And Dan talked about confidence. I think the way you get confidence is going out and beating the crap out of the Patriots. Isn't that it? Like, if that's what you need to build this team, yeah, like, go out there and beat the snot out of them. And I know I'm getting really passionate about this, Brent, because I've been a long-suffering Bills fan, but there should be no other result than just go out, hammer them, do your business, and then get out of there.
Yeah, well, very, very well said. And again, if we're talking about, we threw out the interesting prop there of wind gusts per mile per hour, total points. I don't know. Maybe we want to pitch that to the guys at Inside the Line, Russick, Baskel, and Rapp. I don't know. Maybe they could do something with that on Sunday morning at 10. Before that, though, it'll be the Fantasy Show on Sunday morning with Andy McNamara and Shoal Lee at 8. Of course, that's all leading up to the Bills and Patriots, starting with the pregame at 12:30. And don't think I'm going to leave you out, Matt. If people want some fantasy insight, they absolutely should hit you up on Twitter at MattSN590. That's also where you can find our poll question for tonight. What's the scariest thing in Toronto sports? Well, a Leafs GM tried to throw another thing into the mix today. What's that? I'll tell you when we continue on Sportsnet tonight.
Send us all your money. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher, and we'll send you a free subscription for Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Absolutely free.
Tonight, Brent Gunning, Matt Marchese alongside me. Just had a lot of Bills talk in the last hour. Just finished up a conversation with Dan Fates, a sports anchor down in Buffalo. Now, Matt, you and Dan were talking about a couple of the unnecessary roughness penalties. The Bills, very penalized team, not what they need, especially not what they need this weekend. But I cannot get over the hit that Micah Hyde laid. Now, he got tagged for the unnecessary roughness. I don't know if you recall that hit from the game, but I was watching it and I had to remind myself, I had to give myself a little slap on the wrist because I'm not supposed to like that stuff anymore. But the caveman part of my brain just immediately jumped out and was like, oh, it's like Ravens and Steelers in the mid-2000s. Oh, no, that's bad. We're not supposed to like that anymore. I don't know about you, Matt, but I still, it's not good, I know, in 2020, but I still have a little bit of that bloodlust when I'm watching the NFL.
Yeah, that hit doesn't get penalized even 5 years ago. Maybe not five, but 7 years ago for sure. But you know what, though? When he made the hit, I did feel kind of sick. Because immediately, right after the hit, you knew that something was wrong. And Breshad Perriman has a concussion, and he's not going to play this week. He's already been ruled out. And it's unfortunate because I don't think that Micah Hyde is that type of player. It was just he was just finishing the play, and unfortunately, it ended the way it did. But yeah, it's scary because when you look at these athletes nowadays, they're bigger, faster, stronger, and like a lot of them still have a little bit of reckless abandonment, right? And guys get hurt, and that was the scary thing for me. As soon as it happened, I was like, "Oh, that's a clean hit," and then, "Oh, that's not good," and that was the immediate reaction because the game. I didn't think the Jets were coming back, so was it an unnecessary hit? Maybe just push the guy out of bounds, but that's not how players are taught to play. You're taught to hit, to knock guys down, and you know, jar the ball loose. Like, that's the game that they play. So, yeah, it was a big hit, but it did make me a little bit queasy, I'm not going to lie.
All right, there we go. This also made me think of when I was watching the World Series and Muncy, or I guess this would have been the NLCS, and Max Muncy had a chance to just railroad one of the Dodgers. I think it was Travis d'Arnaud back there. And, I mean, he hit him, but he didn't really hit him. And it's just, again, like, I know what, like, two things can be true. I know what the right thing is, and I also know what the thing I want to see is, and they don't always align. There, that's caveman takes for tonight. Now, you, Matt, you threw out a lovely poll question on, I was going to say ours, it's your, you're the sole owner of your own Twitter account there, at MattSN590. What's the scariest thing for a Toronto sports fan? And, well, over 80% of people say something involving the Leafs, either a Game 7 versus the Bruins or a long-term Matthews injury. Both those things are very scary, but I don't know if you saw this today. something popped up in Leafs land today that, dare I say it, is even scarier than both of those things combined. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Is it a goaltender who catches right-handed by any chance?
Oh, he catches with the wrong hand, and yes, it is Mr. Michael Hutchison I'm talking about. Now, it made a lot of sense when we understand, like, it makes sense as we understand the reasoning for it. Chris Johnston came out with the report of, well, they actually still have to technically pass Aaron Dell through waivers, and if Hutchison's still here in 2 years, he's available to be selected by Seattle. It all made sense. Like, we understand it now. Thank you, Chris Johnston, for talking us all off the ledge. I was not ready to see that today. Hey, good Leafs news. Joey Anderson, that looks like a good piece of business. The Hutchison thing, I was not ready to go down this road again.
No, I don't think anybody was. But I think that Kyle Dubas does get the short end of the stick when it comes to people evaluating moves that he's made. But is there any other grade that we can give him other than, you know, a B plus, maybe even an A minus? He got guys to sign for less money to play there. You know, Joe Thornton's making the league minimum. Wayne Simmonds isn't making all that much. They trade away Andreas Johnsson and they get, you know, a seemingly good player back from some people that I've talked to. They really like Anderson. They've solidified their defense group with a couple of good signings in Brody and Bogosian. I think they're a little bit tougher. So I think that all the moves that they've made have been good. I think when you talk about guys making, like, when they have to adjust, and the adjustment is that Kyle Dubas realized that what his vision was about having this all-skill team wasn't working. And kudos to the guy for realizing that that didn't work and making the decision to change up the nucleus a little bit. Change up some of these guys that can, you know, bring you some toughness, bring in some veteran leadership that this team seems like they desperately needed. Bring in some guys on the back end that will give you a little bit of jam. And all of a sudden you look at the team and go, okay, that looks like a better team. And I don't think there's any question that the Leafs are a better team than they were last year at this point.
Yeah, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it that they've improved. The Joey Anderson specifically, he endeared himself to all of Leafs Nation and me specifically when he was asked who he kind of models his game after, and he says he just wants to be like Zach Hyman. I should probably remind Joey Anderson, Mike Babcock's not the head coach anymore, so that doesn't guarantee anything. But hey, it was a great place to start. In terms of Dubas, the thing, and I've had disagreements with pretty much everybody I've co-hosted with on this, I don't know how much he has actually changed his tune. I think this is just a guy who had prioritized quote-unquote other parts of the plan before. I think it was harder to kind of lock in the skill, and then you take the now second full offseason he's used to kind of fill in the rest. I think in terms of the Andreas Johnsson, I don't think that in a perfect world he would have liked to have moved on from that player, but I think it was just a case of the salary cap kind of dictated. Now, the one thing I will say that I think there is something to be said about, the job was as hard as it was because of moves he had made. Now, I'm not going to kill him for any contract other than the ones he's given out to Justin Hall, Pierre Engvall, and Mitch Marner. I actually think all the others have been fine. But I guess the one area where people could quibble is, well, why was this job so hard? Was it him who painted himself into this corner? And that's an area where I'm really not quite sure on.
I think the Marleau deal was a tough one because they moved a first-round pick. But he didn't offer that contract. The Tavares one is looking like it may be a problem, but in the same breath, is it really a problem if the guy scores, if he gets you 70 points a year, he wins you big face-offs, he plays well in the playoffs? Like, okay, we haven't seen all of that yet, but I think that's the one that's going to be the problem. Having said that, I was totally fine with them moving on from Andreas Johnsson. I think he was going to be only as good as we saw in a Leaf uniform, which was fine. It wasn't anything spectacular. Nick Robertson made Kasperi Kapanen basically expendable, and we're going to see what happens with him. They've signed other guys that we don't know, like Lehtinen is coming in from the KHL. Barabanov is another guy that's coming in from the KHL that we just don't know. Maybe these guys are good players. I know it's a hard adjustment to make going from the KHL to the NHL, and not a lot of guys do it very well, but they got Mikheyev on a cheap deal. They got, like I said, Joe Thornton signed for the league minimum. Jason Spezza signed for the league minimum. Wayne Simmonds took less money, I think, to play in Toronto. So it's not all that bad. I think people are, you know, they are hard on Dubas at some points, and rightfully so on some, like when he kind of talked up Cody Ceci. I mean, no, you just don't do that because he stinks. But in the same breath, he's made a lot more good moves than he has bad moves.
You know what? That when you simply surmise it that way, I think it's great. Boy, it's amazing to think how much easier Kyle Dubas's life in this city could have been if he would have just offered up that pound of flesh at the end of the season and said, Mitch Marner wasn't very good, and neither was Cody Ceci. You'll see one of these guys for the next 7 years, and the other one you won't see ever again. Like, it feels like he could have eliminated so many problems for himself by just doing that. But clearly, like we both agree, he's definitely had a successful, I was about to say summer, but really more of a fall. But either way, good job by the Leafs GM. We will get Greg Wyshynski's thoughts on that as we continue. But coming up next on Sportsnet tonight, going to dive back into Major League Baseball, and specifically, what should the Blue Jays do this offseason? We'll talk about all that and more with Caitlin McGrath when we continue on Sportsnet tonight.
As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake doctor's orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. If sports are the great escapism, consider this your ultimate sports asylum. This is Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Tonight, Brent Gunning, Matt Marchese alongside me. We've got a couple hours left in the program. A little bit of Blue Jays news today. I don't think either of the pieces of news too surprising. Chase Anderson not having his option picked up. Well, the club does exercise the option on Rafael Dolis. Joining us to discuss those moves and what else the Blue Jays might do this offseason, Caitlin McGrath of The Athletic. Caitlin, how are you doing tonight?
Good. How are you?
Doing well. So let's start with the two moves that were made today. I don't think anybody's at all surprised the way either of those moves turned out. I think there's plenty of better ways to spend $9.5 million than on Chase Anderson. What do you make of the two moves today? And do you think there's any chance Anderson finds his way back to Toronto, albeit not at that salary?
Yeah, I agree with you that ultimately, it wasn't surprising. I will say that, especially in the last few days where we've seen so many clubs, like, you know, not exercise pretty pricey options, and some options, like, fairly affordable. So you can really see that clubs are being conscious of their revenues, or of their payroll, I should say, because revenue was obviously down this past season. No fans and stands. It obviously had an impact. And so, you know, like a while ago, you could say that you could look at Chase Anderson at $9.5 million and think that's kind of the price you pay for a starter, right? Like, if you consider the Blue Jays were paying Tanner Roark $12 million and he was arguably worse or just as good as Chase Anderson, or so $9.5 million is not a huge amount of money in baseball terms and in terms of paying for a starting pitcher. But I agree that there's better ways for the Blue Jays to spend that money instead. So they pay him $500,000 as a buyout, they save $9 million, and they can allocate it elsewhere. About whether Chase Anderson finds his way to the Blue Jays, I think it's possible. I don't think it should be their priority. Like, I think they should look around and get some more higher-end starters, because I do think they have pretty good pitching depth. They have a lot of arms, albeit young arms, so not a lot of experience there, but they do have guys that can kind of like be swingman, like a Ross Stripling type, and they have a lot of young guys that can compete for a starting pitching position. So, you know, I think maybe if they need some extra depth, they feel like Chase Anderson would be useful in that way, but I don't think it's a priority right now. I think they need to kind of fill out some more crucial roster positions.
Mark Shapiro seemed very adamant that the team wasn't going to spend this off season, and by not spending, probably not what we saw last season. But do you think that they could be interested in someone like a James Paxton type, who was hurt a lot last year and, you know, certainly wasn't the ideal season for him? That seems like a guy that the Jays would go after, because they love these kind of one-year reclamation projects, don't they?
Yeah, I know that's definitely an option that I think is probably on their radar. He's a left-hander, which would be useful for them as well. I think the Blue Jays will probably want to kind of diversify a little bit. And I think that there's going to have to be sort of a safer bet. And someone that I think would work for that is Taijuan Walker. I think he looked really good as a Blue Jay. It sounds like the two, player and club, really liked each other. He liked playing in Toronto, albeit it wasn't in Toronto, it was in Buffalo. But he just seemed to like the club. And I think that he could probably be a pretty sound sort of middle of the rotation guy. Like, he looked like he had recovered from some of his health issues, which is basically just tied to Tommy John. And then, yeah, like a guy like James Paxton would be a huge upside maybe play. Like, you sign him to maybe not necessarily a one-year deal, because he might be looking for more, but maybe you sign him to some sort of shorter prove-it deal, maybe 2 years or something. And, you know, I think that would be a really interesting move. I do think that he has the track record that he'll get a lot of interest, though. You know, I don't know that I think he's still one of the top arms on the market, so I do think there's going to be interest in him. At the same time, I do think the Blue Jays are well positioned to be a club that can spend a lot, or at least spend good money this year to make their club better. I don't know that they'll sign anyone on a big a deal as they did last year with Hyunjin Ryu. That might not happen, but I do think collectively the Blue Jays could spend close to what they did last year, maybe upwards of $100 million or something, to kind of, you know, build their club up a little bit.
So I think we all agree, and we're talking to Caitlin McGrath, staff writer for The Athletic here on Sportsnet tonight, Brent Gunning, Matt Marchese alongside me. I think we all agree the rotation is far and away the biggest kind of need for this team. But if there's an area outside of that, you know, you mentioned they might not be as aggressive as last year, but they're still going to spend some money. Is there one kind of position that you think would really kind of help this team? I know there's been some talk about Colton Wong at second base. People like that. Maybe it allows Biggio to move elsewhere and kind of free him up. Is there one position that you think kind of adding to would help enhance this team outside of starting pitching?
Yeah, I mean, the infield is really interesting for the Blue Jays, because I do think they have options. You could look at third base as a place where they probably need someone. I don't know that Travis Shaw is going to be coming back. He's kind of a non-tender candidate right now. I guess we'll see what happens with this offseason. But third base, second base, and even shortstop, I think, are areas where you could look to. And I think that you can – the reason I say that is I think you can move guys around. So there's not necessarily a go-to third baseman right now. And Biggio is so flexible that you can move him around the diamond. So if they go and get a second baseman, like you said, Colton Wong is an option, they can move Biggio around. And even Bichette, I think that there's still a lot of organizational faith that he can be an all-star shortstop. He wants to be an all-star shortstop, and I think he's going to go away this winter and work really hard on his defense. But at the same time, he is a team player, and he wants to see the Blue Jays get better. So if they have an opportunity to sign or trade for, you know, a really elite defensive shortstop, I think that he would be willing to move positions to second base maybe, and you know, if it was for the betterment of the team. So I do think they have options. Another position that always gets talked about is center field, but just ultimately I think they have to improve their defense both in the infield and the outfield. So I do think they're going to be needing guys in both those areas. What position they end up being in is kind of up for debate, and I think there's some flexibility there. And center field is just a really hard position to fill, honestly. Like, there's not a great market for it other than George Springer, and he's going to be probably one of the best free agents just across the board. After that, it really drops off for center field. So I think the Blue Jays probably don't want to go into this off-season necessarily saying we need this position. They kind of want to be open-minded and flexible and know that they can kind of maneuver and find the best player possible and kind of fit him into the lineup however it makes their team best, if that makes sense.
Caitlin, two names that kind of stuck out to me that maybe fit, and one is a little bit more of a pipe dream than the other. Maybe they're both pipe dreams. Maybe I'm just crazy. But two guys with Cleveland connections, and one is Trevor Bauer, which is the pipe dream, and the other one's Michael Brantley. Do you think that the Jays will kick tires on both of those players?
I would agree that Trevor Bauer is probably like a pipe dream. I don't know that the Blue Jays will really be in that market. I just think he'll demand a lot, and I think that, I don't know, I can't really see it happening, but maybe. I think they'll certainly inquire about it. It just seems like it might be, he's not quite Garrett Cole level, but it just seems like he'll be the guy this offseason, and I don't know if the Blue Jays are really going to be a contender in that, but interesting to watch. Michael Brantley, I have mentioned his name a few times in articles, and I do think he makes a lot of sense for the Blue Jays, just because he's an older, experienced player, but he's still very productive. He makes a lot of contact. He doesn't strike out a lot. I think that the Blue Jays lineup kind of lacked that experience this year a little bit. We all know they're a very young team, and that's an advantage for them. I think they're a pretty young, exciting team, and they've got a lot of good young players, but they did kind of lack that kind of disciplined, experienced bat in the middle of their lineup, or somewhere in their lineup at least. And, you know, he's still a pretty good defender in the outfield. I don't think he's quite center field caliber anymore, but he can still play left field. And then he can DH. He did that a lot this year for Houston, and he can kind of play that dual role. And the Blue Jays like to move the DH around, and they like to be flexible with it. I think ultimately he would fit really well with the club, and you're right, he does have that Cleveland connection. Again, I think he'll be a pretty popular guy this winter, although it's really tough to say because I think this offseason is going to be really interesting because it's going to be unlike anything that we've seen. Probably not great, honestly, if you want to see guys get paid good money for their play. But I think he is going to be one of the guys that's probably looked at by a lot of clubs.
I feel like you got to go like full weirdo pitch with Trevor Bauer, like playing in Canada. We'll let you wear the red jerseys every time you pitch. Like you just got to like if that's what you want to do, you've just got to appeal to his like complete out of the box persona there. One thing I've been wondering about this team, and obviously they'll have a pretty good handle on this right now, and they'll have even a better answer heading into when the next season starts. But given the uncertainty still around where the Blue Jays will be next year, I guess it'll be here or in Buffalo. But we know this team is so analytically inclined, and obviously, you know, different types of players succeed in different types of parks, more specifically pitchers. Do you think that at all affects how they or which type of players they could be looking to bring in this winter?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that they'll be thinking about like park effects, just because if they're targeting a guy, a pitcher, for example, they're probably looking at more than a one-year deal necessarily, especially if it's a big play for somebody that they want to be part of their club for a number of years, especially heading into years where they're in more contention. So I don't know if that would have a huge role in terms of who they would pursue. I think they just want to pursue good players that would fit with the club. I do think on the other side of it, though, on the player side of it, the uncertainty around the Blue Jays and where they'll play is something that we have to consider. We know that playing in Canada has its advantages, but it also can be a difficult sell for some players. You know, it's about moving your family to a different country. A lot of players may not be familiar with Canada. We have to consider, you know, they may not want to live in a place where it's colder in April and May even, right? So players have their own interests and they have their priorities. And then on top of that, you would have to understand that they might not even know if they're going to be in Toronto or not. And selling a free agent on potentially playing in a minor league ballpark, I'm not even sure we can say Buffalo for sure, because if the minor leagues are happening, the Bisons will be playing in there. So there's a lot of uncertainty around Toronto. I think the answer the front office would give, and they've said this, is that they would just try to sell their team to the player, right? Like they would just say, we're a young, exciting team, and we want you to be a part of it. And if a player kind of understands that a multi-year deal would stretch over, presumably would reach normal times again, and they'd be back in Toronto at some point, that would be a selling point. But I think it's a factor this winter.
Oh, normal times. Maybe one day we'll actually get there. Now, I was kind of thinking about, and speaking of normal times, we saw a lot of players. Tanner Roark immediately jumps out to mind, really pushing back against the new school idea, especially with how starting pitchers are handled, and get them out before they're the third time through the order. I don't think this team is going to be the Blue Jays. Like, by no stretch do I think that will be the case. But do you see a world where there's a team out there who kind of appeals to free agents by saying, hey, we will let you guys be more pitchers. We will kind of let you have that more kind of old school approach, work through a jam, get into the sixth inning? Because it feels like a lot of guys across baseball are clamoring for it. And if the money is going to be relatively equal in different places, I wonder if that's something that could become a bit of a tiebreaker.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I don't know the answer to that necessarily, but you could see a club. I wouldn't be surprised if the market or the teams try, you know, teams are always trying different things in baseball. And I wouldn't be surprised if one day you see a team go the opposite way and say, all these other teams are zigging this way and they're, you know, pulling in relievers in the sixth inning or even earlier. Or they're, you know, and we're going to go the opposite way and we're going to go old school and then we're going to use our starting pitchers to the eighth inning. Like, I think there's probably patterns in baseball and I think history repeats itself. And I wouldn't be surprised if there's a club down the road that goes back to more traditional thinking just to see how it works, or just to kind of zag when everyone's zigging or whatever you want to say. Whether that's a factor in selling guys, I think that could be, in my opinion, I think that could be a bit dangerous because then you're kind of giving promises that maybe you can't necessarily keep. I don't know if you'd want to sell someone on that, but I also think there's some pitchers where they're just capable of doing it and some pitchers maybe aren't. And there is a lot of data to back up the fact that, you know, third time through the order is less effective for many pitchers. I do have to think we have to consider that a lot of the younger guys that are going to start entering free agency soon and just coming up in the system probably are going to have grown up more in the era of analytics and these types of thinking. So you mentioned Tanner Roark, and he's an older guy, and he grew up in a different era, and he came up through the minors in a different era. You're going to have guys now coming up where they have just lived through this almost their entire career. You're talking about high schools and college programs that are, some of them are even more analytically inclined than the major league. So I do think that there's going to be a different perception maybe from pitchers on that soon. But yeah, I think it's a really interesting discussion and maybe it'll come up, maybe it would come up in free agent talks and maybe a team would have to sort of, I don't know, make some soft promises, but maybe no guarantees.
Caitlin, one guy that was kind of linked and he has been, I guess, a little bit this as the offseason approach was Justin Turner. And we all know what happened after game six and him going on the field and all that kind of stuff. Do you think that if the Jays had interest in him prior to that, that maybe their interest has waned a little bit because of what happened?
I think that it would have to be a factor. And maybe it would be a character thing, right? The Blue Jays are always, always, always talking about character and bringing in the best guys for their club. And on the flip side, you know, hear all these glowing things about Justin Turner from the Dodgers, and he's like the glue that holds that team together. And then you sort of see his acts, and from an outsider's perspective, it just seemed very selfish of him. And, you know, I understand wanting to celebrate, but, you know, bigger picture here, right? And so I do think that it would be a factor. I also think with Justin Turner, I think he's such a Dodger for life now that I would have a hard time seeing him land with another club, I should say. And, you know, I do think he'll ultimately probably end up with the Dodgers. Another factor, I think I saw this, I don't know, on Twitter or something, someone brought it up, and it didn't even occur to me, but teams would also probably have to consider whether there's going to be some kind of punishment for what he did, right? If he has to serve a suspension or whatever happens, a club signing him next year would have to consider that maybe he's not available to start the season for them as well. So I do think if teams were considering him, now they just have to understand that if bringing him into the club could be potentially a bit of a PR hit, it might not be the type of guy you want to bring into a club. The Blue Jays were one of the teams that were saying that they were taking COVID protocols very seriously, and it seemed by their actions they didn't really have any positive tests when the season started. So you would think that they were taking it pretty seriously. So, you know, I do think our front office would have to really deeply consider whether they want to bring him into the club.
Well, the one thing I think we can all agree on is that everyone in baseball would have a very calm and measured reaction if Justin Turner gets suspended more than any Astro did. I'm sure everyone would just react to that very calmly, very rationally. No need to lash out. Caitlin, very much enjoyed the chat tonight. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
There she goes. Caitlin McGrath, staff writer for The Athletic. Matt, I'm sure everyone would react calmly to that, or probably I'm wrong and people would lose it if Justin Turner got suspended more than any Astro did.
Well, remember the outlash that there was after Joe Kelly got suspended for throwing at Astros players? Yeah, I'm sure it would all be taken very, very tempered and very measured takes after the suspension comes down. My only thing with the suspension, if there is one, is there's no precedent. Like, this has literally never happened before. So I don't know if you can have any sort of expectation, A, but B, how you can get mad, because there's nothing to compare it to.
You're wondering how a sports fan can get mad? The day ends in Y, and that's how. I mean, if you're a Leaf fan, literally anything, any day can set you off. Oh, game 7 against Boston. You threw it in the poll question. But yeah, I mean, you're right. Like, it's definitely, I think the thing that's like kind of confusing people about that is the Astros is always going to be, whenever there is a punishment that people deem too heavy or just not right, this is for the next, I don't know, probably decade, I honestly think it's going to hang around of how can you suspend blank for blank when the Astros didn't get anything for stealing the World Series? And look, we understand the legalese of why. We don't have to like it. And I honestly think that this is going to kind of linger over all discipline in baseball for all things for close to a decade. I really feel that way.
Yeah, you're probably not wrong in that. And it is true, though. And I guess you compare anything to the Astros. The Astros, basically anything short of murder, I think, will get compared to, and there will be such an outcry for, well, he didn't do anything as bad as the Astros did. Like, murder is really the only thing that they wouldn't get upset about the length of suspension.
That's right. Little murder talk on the eve of Halloween. Very, very fitting here on Sportsnet tonight. Something that's scary, the Leafs. They brought in Michael Hutchison. We'll ask Greg Wyshynski about that. Then he'll ask us, why are you asking me about a third or potentially fourth goalie? There's lots to get into in the NHL. We will do all that with Greg Wyshynski when we continue here on Sportsnet tonight.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Trucking along here on Sportsnet tonight, Brent Gunning, Matt Marchese alongside me. Very, very happy to be joined by our next guest, Greg Wyshynski, covering the NHL for ESPN. Greg, how you doing tonight?
Doing well. It's great to be here, boys. Thanks for having me.
I'm thrilled to have you. Obviously, there are sunnier topics to discuss in the NHL, but I think most people right now, their mind is kind of on the Coyotes and the Mitchell Miller situation there. I think enough has been said about it. We have all, you know, crapped on the actions because they're indefensible. But I think the one thing that I keep coming back to is how much of this do you think was simply the Coyotes thinking there just weren't a lot of eyeballs on them and they'd be able to get by on this pick without having any pushback because they're the Coyotes?
Well, I don't know if it's because they're the Coyotes, but I also think it's because it's the fourth round. I mean, the prospects writers that I've spoken to just kind of on background about this to get a better sense of how this slips so off the radar leading up to the draft. I mean, one, obviously it wasn't a traditional draft. If we're all in the big room together, maybe this gets bandied about and the story comes out a little bit quicker. But I also think it's just one of those deals where people were cognizant of something having happened in this guy's past. They weren't necessarily cognizant of the details until the Arizona Republic judged him up again. And they certainly weren't cognizant of the fact that he hadn't apologized to the victim. And he still hasn't, even through the statement he put out through the Coyotes. So, you know, to me, I think it's one of those deals where maybe not because of the Coyotes, but because of where he was drafted that they thought maybe they can slip this through. And again, you know, the bottom line is that this is just another in a long tradition of NHL teams overlooking toxicity in a player's background to, you know, acquire talent. I mean, it doesn't happen maybe as often as it does in some other sports, but it certainly does happen in hockey. And I think the takeaway from this, the fresh take on this, if you will, is the fact that times are changing. And, you know, like the Coyotes getting called out and North Dakota getting called out. I mean, some people may see it as, you know, cancel culture or whatever nonsense. But the bottom line is that it keeps them honest. It keeps them on their toes. And when you hear about teams not having put Mitchell Miller on their draft board because they knew their consumer base wouldn't accept the pick, that's a huge change in this game and a positive step for the NHL.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that, Greg. I produce Hockey Central with one of your former cohorts in Jeff Merrick, so you'll be happy to know that he is the exact same as he was then when you did Merrick versus Wyshynski. But Brian Burke has said multiple times on the show that they have each team has a, or should have, a do not draft list. So the fact that Arizona thought that they could kind of get away with this, and even back to North Dakota, the fact that they thought that, well, we know about this because you should know about that kind of stuff, and we think we can get away with it, is just the arrogance of some organizations, and in this case, one an educational institution, that thinks that they can get away with this kind of stuff. And you're right. It is so refreshing to see people get called on their actions, because as someone who grew up in hockey and someone who played junior hockey and was in a junior hockey locker room, this sport desperately needs a culture shock.
For sure. And so there's two reactions to that. The first is that it is refreshing, and I think times are certainly changing. I think the difference is that maybe not that the Coyotes in North Dakota thought they could get away with it. It's that they thought they could explain it away, right? Like their take on it, both organizations was, you know, we're aware of what this guy did. It was eighth grade. We think we can provide the structure and the system for him to change his ways and be a leading model for the fight against bullying and assault against, you know, classmates of color or whatever. And so they thought they had a good rap on how to defend the pick, right? It turns out that nobody was buying it. So I think that's one major change. And the other thing, too, is that, and the example I've been kind of giving to people when we've been talking about this, I mean, in 2020, it's a much different league than it was even 10 years ago. 10 years ago, don't you think Slava Voynov would have found a new home in this league by now, right? And yet, because of everything that went on with him, with the domestic abuse, and because of the current climate in the league and in sports and in society, even though this guy was an elite defenseman, you know, when he was playing with Los Angeles Kings, and even though that's a position of need for almost every team in this league, he's radioactive. You know, and I think the Mitchell Millers of the world are going to be radioactive going forward. And that's, like you said, a positive step forward for hockey culture to have these teams, even if they're, you know, kind of forced into it by financial considerations and boycotts and protests and things like that. At least there's something there that's giving them pause and making them, you know, shy away from investing in toxic talent.
Yeah, I mean, personally, myself, I'm a big believer in you get forced or shamed into the right decision often enough, and eventually you just start to make it all on your own without having to do those things.
Right.
I'd also add to that that, you know, as much as Matt works alongside Jeff every day, you can't know if it's exactly the same because they have trained professionals who push the buttons to make the microphones work, unlike when I was doing that for the Merrick vs. Wyshynski pod. And, Jeff would get a little upset at me when I didn't have the buttons pushed ever so much. Now, okay, I've got you laughing. Now, let's keep the good times rolling. We've talked about the serious topic. We've given its due diligence. Now, you're chuckling here. Of course, I can't think of Merrick versus Wyshynski without thinking of hologram Bill Masterton. Now, there was a hologram Bruce Kardashian going around Bruce Jenner the other day going around. Now, what makes you more happy? The chance that we can revive hologram Bill Masterton jokes, or I know you're a big nerd. Season 2 of The Mandalorian coming out today, I think. What has you more excited?
Well, The Mandalorian, I mean, the hologram Bill Masterson bit, for those who don't know, was a bit that Jeff and I cooked up where we hoped that hologram technology could one day get to the point where Bill Masterton could hand out the Bill Masterson trophy and then shame the players that win the trophy for not having a strong enough sob story compared to him dying was the whole bit. And it was a great bit, and it continued on through many years of the podcast. Now, I'm fired up with The Mandalorian. I stayed up until like 2 o'clock in the morning last night watching it. And you know, I'm a huge Star Wars fan, and you know, your mileage may vary on where the product of that franchise is at this point. But I think across the board, The Mandalorian gets it right. And the smartest, the greatest thing about sci-fi and when sci-fi really works, when you use sci-fi and graft it onto the sort of skeleton of another genre. So even though it's not sci-fi, for example, like The Dark Knight is basically Michael Mann's Heat, but, you know, with Batman and the Joker. And so The Mandalorian is basically just a Western, right, where you've got, you know, the episode last night, you got the gunslinger coming to town, you got the local sheriff, you've got what used to be the Native Americans. Now they're the Tusken Raiders on Tatooine. Like, the whole thing just works if you use something else as a template and just throw Star Wars at it. And that's why if you haven't seen it, it's just a tremendously good show.
Oh, I mean, you also buried the lead, Baby Yoda. Very, very cute. You can't overstate that part. Now, jumping back to hockey, because there's no way to do a smooth transition from Baby Yoda to Mike Hoffman. Why don't teams want him to score goals for them? It feels like, yes, he has his warts as a player, but boy, it'd be nice to have 20 goals floating around and some guy who could shoot the puck on your power play. A little weird for me that he's without a home.
Well, first of all, he didn't put the puck in the net all too often on the power play or enough to really warrant that being a virtue, I think, that you put out there. And he's a tremendous 5-on-5 scorer and certainly an asset in your top six offensively. But it's a combination of a couple of things. I mean, you know, we saw Dadonov, for example, go already to the Senators. I think he has a more complete game than Hoffman does. I think Hoffman's defensive liabilities are a real issue with him trying to command the money that he's probably looking for, commiserate to his offensive output. But you know, I just feel like, you know, there's going to be just certain players that are squeezed by this unprecedented market that we see. Not only are the good teams where Hoffman might want to go all booked up because of the flat cap, but it could also be a situation where even if some of them do have the space to maybe add him, they're just waiting and waiting and waiting to see if the price will come down, because as we get closer and closer to the start of whenever the season's going to be, you're going to have players scrambling for those few extra dollars that are left in the player pool for these good teams. I mean, there's always going to be a place for him to land if he wants to sign with, like, the Devils or something like that, right? But, like, if he wants to go and play for a contender, they're going to wait it out and see if they can maybe get him even on a discount as the free agent gets more desperate.
Greg, Rick Bowness, I guess you could say he re-ups with Dallas, but he does stay on as the head coach as they take the interim tag away. This kind of seemed like the no-brainer for both sides, but was there ever a sense in your mind that maybe Rick Bowness didn't want the reins as a head coach, because he seemed to be doing pretty darn good as an assistant coach for all those years, and he really never lucked out as a head coach in any situation because he always had bad teams?
It's a really good question. I mean, you know, he didn't really have a desire. I talked to him when he first got the job, and obviously got the job under duress. I mean, with a Jim Montgomery situation, and he wasn't too hip to taking the head coaching job. I mean, he was very happy, you know, serving the role that he had. He was, you know, content, I think, to be an assistant coach going forward, as he was in Tampa and a bunch of places before he came to Dallas. But I think he really grew to love it. I think he really grew to love this team. And it's hard to, I think, take a step back to a different role once you've gotten a taste of this kind of playoff run. And let's be honest, I mean, he knows what the situation is. I mean, they've got outstanding goaltending. They've got two outstanding defensemen that can play, you know, 50 minutes of a 60-minute game for you. He's got a lot of offensive weaponry. He's got some good young players. He's got an owner that, you know, despite the huge financial hit he's taken in his hospitality industry, has never been afraid to invest in the team if it's warranted. So he's in a really good spot. And so, you know, the question then becomes, was it lightning in a bottle? Is he the kind of coach that you want to, you know, sign and bring back and hope that you can do the same thing over again? And normally I'd say no. Normally I would say, you know, go out there and get Gerard Gallant or whatever. But I think the magic to this team was that he was there from the beginning with Montgomery. Montgomery had them playing a very specific system, a very specific style. And then it was Bonus's changes and tweaks to that style, opening it up a little bit more for the defensemen and things like that, that enabled Dallas to go on the run that they did. So he might have the secret sauce for this recipe. And it's worth trying to see if maybe they can make another run at it with the team that they currently have.
Yeah, well, well said. I think a team who changed up their sauce quite a bit this offseason. Got to get your thoughts on the local team. The Leafs certainly made a ton of changes. I think most people here tend to think they're better for it. What do you make of what the Leafs did this offseason?
Yeah, I think overall they're better for it. I mean, especially if you're looking at the blue line, I love the Brody move. I think that's a real smart decision. They've been obviously after him for a very long time. What gives me pause, even with the addition of Thornton, who, you know, let's face it now, it made it very difficult for people that love Joe Thornton but absolutely hate the Leafs to approach next season because they've got a lot of competing loyalties. Their bottom six gives me a little bit of concern, right? I mean, you know, you look at the teams that have made runs in this league. You look at the teams that currently are favored to win the Cup. They are crazy deep at forward. They go four lines deep. It's not to say the Leafs can't throw together some combinations that might get them to that point, but just on paper right now, even with the addition of Thornton and with Spezza coming back, you look at that group and you're just like, I don't know if there's really that Barclay Goodrow, Blake Coleman, Yanni Gord group that's really going to, you know, jump out and be a factor in your bottom six. And so that's my point of concern. But everything else, I think Kyle Dubas did a really good job and did a really good job with the financial constraints that everybody had due to the flat cap.
Yep, very, very well said. I have one more for you before we let you go. Now, I've made you chuckle. That's always good during an interview. We talked to you about The Mandalorian. I know you love that, but I think I found something you might have loved even a little bit more, and that was watching the apparent downfall of Canadian society after Bobby Orr shared who he thinks you should vote for in the upcoming election. I know you thoroughly enjoyed that. Your quick thoughts there.
Well, you know, it was an amazing thing to see. I mean, like, you know, you've got people pouring their hearts out about, you know, an idol turning his back on you because of the politician he supports. And, you know, my first reaction is, who the hell do you think's playing in the NHL? I mean, it's the GOP. That's who plays in the NHL. I mean, for God's sakes. And you know, most of them aren't like outward Trump guys, but they're definitely outward, please don't take my money through taxes guys. They've always been that way. So I never approach a hockey player thinking that he's a bleeding heart liberal. The thing that really bothered me about Orr's thing today, besides the fact that he's buying an advertisement in a newspaper in a community in which he doesn't live, was the notion of, if you read the ad, it seems as though he's making the argument that presidents don't sign up to have to manage their countries through a pandemic. And that maybe it's like Trump's golf game where he should just get a mulligan on COVID because it was unexpected. Like you know, like 9/11, you know, wars, hurricanes, like all of this stuff is not expected. It's kind of the basis of the job that you're supposed to be ready for this stuff. So, I mean, if this is the argument, like, hey, you know, the U.S. was rocking and rolling and everybody was making money in the Dow Jones before the pandemic hit, sure, you could say that. But it's also true that the president's the guy that has to navigate you through the choppy waters. And, I mean, I don't know what the hell Bobby Orr is thinking, but I think a lot of people don't believe that's necessarily what's been done here. But, again, listen, I got PTSD from 2016. I ain't going to make no predictions about what's happening on Tuesday.
Yeah, very well said. Me and my co-hosts have the honor of being on the air that night. So, yeah, that'll be a fun show to do. Booking a lot of American guests, I'm sure, really just to take their mind off of everything as opposed to actually getting their insights on stuff. Wish thoroughly enjoyed getting to talk to you again.
Listen,
please, what do you got?
I would be happy to come on next Tuesday if you have a couch that you can offer me for the next 4 years, depending on how things are going.
Yeah,
we got space.
We can do that. We can do that. I produce your podcast poorly enough. Maybe I could try to redeem myself with allowing you
come
to sleep with my coach. Greg, thanks so much for the time. Really, really enjoyed it.
Anytime.
There he goes, Greg Wyshynski. You might be hearing him on Tuesday, might be hearing him sob, might be hearing him laugh, probably hearing him cry. Greg Wyshynski, ESPN, NHL. Lots we got into there. Matt, I think we should probably just touch again quickly our thoughts on the Coyotes and the Mitchell Miller situation there. You know, this isn't one I wanted to come off the top. People who know me know I'm completely unabashed to, you know, state my opinion on stuff, and I don't want to, you know, dink and dock my opinions on stuff, but I think this is one issue where there's just really only, it's not even a side, it's just what is the right thing to feel about this, and I think everybody kind of feels that way. So I'm going to kind of speak for, you know, a lot of the guys who do these shows on this station. And I think if you haven't heard us out here banging the table at how reprehensible everything he did was, I think I can speak for all of my co-hosts when I say it absolutely was. But I also think we kind of try to strike the right balance between tackling issues that we can wrap our heads around. But this one, to me, quite honestly, just feels like there's nothing to wrap my head around. It's disgusting. And I think all parties involved have now taken the right steps.
There's no gray area here. There really isn't. And that's what it kind of comes down to is, do you want to be on the wrong side or the right side when it comes to this argument? Because I don't see a situation where you can look at it and go, well, you know, he was a kid. No, I'm sorry. That doesn't play here. Okay, it's absolutely unacceptable what he did. It's despicable. It's disgusting. It's every adjective that you want to describe something that's completely awful. And yet, this guy gets away with like 20 hours of community service for this. He still manages to have a hockey career out of this and never once apologizes to the other kid, the victim in this. I mean, there's no other way. My only concern would be that, yes, in society, people do deserve second chances. I'm fine with him being kicked off the hockey team, but I don't think that it was enough to, I don't know if, I'm assuming he had his scholarship taken away by North Dakota, but I would hope that he didn't get kicked out of the school, because he still needs to learn, and this is a learning experience, but educationally, he needs to learn as well. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. That's the only thing that I think there's a gray area on, but everything else, I'm good with. The Coyotes renouncing the draft rights, him getting kicked off the hockey team at North Dakota, that stuff I'm okay with, because there should be punishment for stuff like that.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. And I've seen a lot of people saying, oh, should he lose his NHL career, the chance at one over this? I mean, if quite honestly, if he does, I'm not crying for him. But here's the thing. If this kid goes and has a successful collegiate career and proves he has learned and grown and all of those things, and this is far and away the least important part of all of this. But if that happens, you know what's going to happen? Somebody's going to pick him up as an undrafted free agent, and he will have to do the sit-down interview about everything he learned, because he should have to explain exactly what is different about him now. Because again, like you said, the fact that he still hasn't apologized, I'm going to assume that has to do with something legally, but it's unacceptable. It's unacceptable what he did. It's unacceptable that he hasn't apologized. And like I said, I think we're all happy to see that now all sides, excluding him, because he's yet to apologize, are taking the right steps forward. The Coyotes renouncing the draft pick, and he will not be playing hockey where he was on scholarship. If he's not playing hockey, I can't imagine he'll still have the scholarship. We'll see what happens with him if we hear from him again. But I think what Wish said made a lot of sense there. The NHL, even if they're being dragged kicking and screaming, they're slowly finding their way to the light on these issues. One league who lives in the light, quite honestly, is the National Basketball Association, the NBA. There's a lot going on with them. Where are the Raptors going to play? When's the league going to start? What's going on in Brooklyn? Lots of NBA news and notes to kick around when we continue on Sportsnet tonight.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Job, Danielle, on the music tonight, keeping us on the air. We just talked about how poor I was at that job. Danielle Furtado doing an incredible job tonight. Want to thank her and want to thank our producer, JR Manitad, for putting the program together. Got a little more than an hour left of it. We'll conclude a little football talk in the next hour. Also hear from OHL Commissioner and CHL President David Branch. He joined Writer's Block today. There's a lot of controversy about hitting in the OHL and what's going on. We'll dive into all that after after we hear from David Branch in the next hour of the show. But right now, plenty to talk about with regarding the NBA, specifically the start date. The NBA, this is all coming from Adrian Wojnarowski, as pretty much all news from the NBA does. The NBA wants a shortened 72-game season with the December 22nd start, but playing fewer games than that in a potential January start hasn't been raised yet. That's according to sources. So, Matt, I think we had this conversation with baseball. What's a legitimate season? Does it matter? Baseball more than lopped their season in half, and I think we all considered that a legitimate season. Is there an amount of games for you the NBA could get to where you start to have a real problem about the lack of length in the regular season?
I think anything less than 50 or 60 games becomes a bit of an issue for me. But at the end of the day, Brent, I think when we look at this, I think we'll take kind of anything at this point, seeing that we saw what happened with the other sports and how maybe for a bit we took sports for granted. But having said that, I think that 60 games is probably the right number, and I think that a start in January probably makes a little bit more sense. And the reason why I say that is because you get to see what happens with this virus over the course of a little bit of the winter, kind of see how things are going, and then from there you can kind of adjust how you need to adjust. So I'm okay with 60 games. I'm okay with them starting in January, but I think anything else, you're kind of getting into some, maybe not dangerous territory, but some territory that you don't want to be in, because also their TV contracts are based on games played. So they got to get in a certain amount of games if they want to make a certain amount of money. And cash is king right now. So that's going to be a huge thing for these leagues to determine how many games that they play this season. A lot of it is determined on the virus, but there's a lot of it that's also determined on what the TV networks want.
Yeah, I think it's TV networks, and then what the TV networks want is in turn then what the owners want, because I think that, you know, Christmas Day is such an important day for that league. We know how often we talk about, oh, will the Raptors get a Christmas date? Like, it really means you've kind of arrived. But I do think the league has an important kind of balancing task with getting that and having a great start date, with also making sure the teams that played deep into, I guess, October or September would be able to have enough rest. But then you also have to battle that with the fact that there have been teams who haven't been playing since March, so you don't want them to have this over amount of rust. It feels like they really have to do a fine job of threading the needle here. Of course, I'd like basketball sooner rather than later. I think that kind of Christmas start date, it would be magical. But I have to be honest, like, for me, it really does feel like it feels like it's kind of pushing things a little bit quick. Switching gears, but staying in the NBA, big topic of contemplation, consternation. Where are the Raptors going to play? We know there was some talk about Louisville. The players themselves quickly put the kibosh on that. But now we know that New York State Senator Timothy Kennedy, he has written a letter. He's campaigning to the NBA and to Masai Ujiri to have the Raptors use Buffalo as their temporary home. How would you feel about the Raptors setting up shop in Buffalo? And if it's not going to be Toronto, does it really matter where they play to you?
I don't think it really matters. We can't go see the games anyway. Buffalo, I guess, makes sense because of proximity. Again, we saw it with the Blue Jays. So I guess it's the best of a bad situation. My concern would be I don't know where they're going to play, because it won't be I don't even know what the arena is called now in Buffalo.
It's had a lot of names.
So many times, yeah. And so I don't think that is compatible for an NBA team, but I guess they could play out of one of the colleges nearby, but that's not really ideal either because of facilities. I really don't know what the situation is. I'm sure they'll make it work one way or another. I know Patrick Mahomes and the mayor of Kansas City were pushing for the Raptors to be in Kansas City. It'd be cool to have Patrick Mahomes as a Raptor fan, but I don't think it matters one way or another. As long as they have a place to play, I'm good with wherever they end up.
Yeah, if it's not going to be here, it doesn't really matter to me either. I think you obviously want to find the best kind of facilities you can, because I think that's something that the Raptors have pumped a ton of money into. You know, not that they're unique in the NBA in that regard, but they just built that brand new training center, the OVO, the Drake Center, whatever it's called, sitting on the waterfront there. They have pumped a ton of money into making sure that every guy on this team has all the you know, medical and physical devices they have that they need there. So I think it's going to be important to find the right place. I definitely think that it definitely makes things more difficult. It's not like with the Blue Jays where they have that relationship with the Bisons. Wherever they end up, it's going to be hopefully just a 1 year off. We'll see what ends up happening with that. What else we'll see, or more specifically for this station here, you'll be able to hear the Bills and Patriots on Sunday, starting with the pregame at 12:30. We will get you set for that game. We've got one more hour of Sportsnet tonight when we continue. And when we come back, we'll talk to Zach Cox teeing up the Patriots and Bills on Sunday.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Do not settle. Demand. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. If only there was a way to engineer the human eyeball to watch 10 different screens at once. Keep your eyes and ears on every game with Sportsnet tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Final hour here of Sportsnet tonight. Brent Gunning, Matt Marchese alongside me. Just heard a couple of terrifying things in honor of Halloween, I think, in the update. The OHL may not have body checking. Yeah, the commissioner of that league, not so certain. We'll have David Branch in the next segment of the show. Also, yes, the Leafs. Michael Hutchison, he's back. Don't worry, he probably won't actually play games. Something else very scary to people in these parts normally, the New England Patriots. Joining us now to tee up Bills Patriots this weekend is Zach Cox, Patriots beat writer of with Nesson and co-host of the Nesson Patriots podcast. Zach, how you doing today?
Doing well, guys. Thanks for having me.
Oh, very, very happy to have you on. So this matchup, this Bills-Patriots matchup, it's unlike any we have seen in the past. Oh, I don't know. It feels like two decades between these two teams. Can you know, here in this market, there's been a lot of talk of, I don't know, there's still that Patriots magic. Looking at New England, I'm not so sure how much of it's left. Can you make a case at all for the Patriots upset on Sunday?
I think that case probably has more to do with the way Buffalo has played of late than the way the Patriots have played of late, because the Patriots have been a disaster in the last couple of games, especially in this last game against the San Francisco 49ers last week. They were blown out, most lopsided home loss of the Belichick era. Cam Newton has looked really bad since he came back from the COVID-19 list. Now Julian Edelman's out, N'Keal Harry's out, Stephon Gilmore might not play in this game, so there's not a lot going right for the Patriots at the moment. Given their history, you've got to give them a chance in this game, considering how successful they have been in Buffalo and how the Bills have looked a little shaky in these last couple weeks. But, yeah, it was Devin McCourty, the Patriots safety, said this week that you would be crazy to say that the Patriots are currently the team to beat in the AFC East, and I would have to agree with him on that one.
As a Bills fan, this is I get nightmares and wake up in a cold sweat thinking about playing the Patriots because of the Bill Belichick factor. But, you know, what this looked like a really good spot for Cam Newton, especially the way the season started. Now with all the injuries surrounding him, plus his COVID diagnosis, is this now looking like the best spot for Cam Newton? Or is there any chance that they talk extension with him? I don't know if there's an injury going on. Maybe you can fill us in on that.
Yeah, it's been it's kind of interesting how that whole conversation has changed just in the last couple of weeks, because coming off of that Seattle game in week two where he really lit it up as a passer, people around here were saying, yeah, go ahead, try to get this guy to an extension while you can. And now, just a couple weeks later, he really has not looked like the same quarterback. He's played his worst game of the season 3 weeks in a row now. It's just been sort of a downward slide. I mean, maybe this is a case of him sort of still adjusting to the offense. He talked about that a little bit this week. He was away from practice for 2 weeks while he was on the COVID-19 list, so that certainly didn't help. Maybe this is something that with a little bit more time will work itself out, because he did look very good in those first couple of weeks of the season. But yeah, the feelings around that whole quarterback situation have changed pretty dramatically just within the last couple of weeks. And Cam Newton was benched in this past game, and he'll probably lose his starting job if he continues to play the way he has. But Jarrett Stidham, the backup, hasn't looked particularly impressive either. So it's kind of uncharted waters for the Patriots at the quarterback position right now.
What's the conversation in New England been like regarding Belichick? I mean, obviously, let's just start stating the obvious. Bill Belichick and Tom Brady both helped one another reach heights they probably could not have reached on their own. Okay, there. We've said the thing that I think all people agree to. But has there been any pushback of just how great is this Belichick with the way this Patriots team has looked and obviously the way Brady's looking in Tampa?
I don't know if it's quite reached that level, but there are definitely some people around here that are not particularly happy with the way that this current team has been constructed, especially on the offensive side. I mean, you look at their receivers and their tight ends from top to bottom. That's probably the weakest group of pass catchers in the NFL. And the Patriots didn't really do a ton to improve that group this past offseason. And they didn't draft anybody at the position. They brought in Damir Bird, who was kind of a mid-level to low-level free agent, passed on all of those top-tier free agents. They did draft a couple of tight ends in the third round, and we've seen some signs of life from those guys lately. But overall, I mean, this was the biggest issue for this team last year, was their lack of talent on the offensive side, and was one of the primary reasons why Tom Brady was so disappointed here during his last year in New England. And the fact that those problems are still problems a year later definitely has some people pretty unhappy with the way that Bill Belichick has kind of handled himself from a roster management perspective in these last couple of years.
Well, I mean, Brady definitely had years in New England where he had tons of weapons. Like, we don't need to rehash them all. Obviously, you know, there were plenty of guys who put up record-setting numbers with him. But, you know, it's also being kind of an Achilles heel of Belichick. It feels like he's really struggled to find skill position players, be they running backs, be they wide receivers. You know, how much of a concern is Bill Belichick, the GM, to Bill Belichick, the coach?
I think some of it is a little bit overblown because those are such high profile positions, and they do kind of command a lot more attention than a lot of maybe the less sexy positions. But Bill Belichick has been very good at finding offensive line talent. He's been very good at finding talent on the defensive side, especially in the secondary. I mean, there's a reason that the Patriots have been so good for so long. And it's not just because of Bill Belichick, the coach, and it's not just because of Tom Brady, the quarterback. The kind of talent acquisition side definitely plays into that. So I think some of the Bill, the GM gripes are a little bit unfounded. But, I mean, when you look at the roster as it's constructed right now, people who are complaining about this skill position group not being talented enough are entirely accurate. I mean, it's tough to imagine any quarterback, and Cam Newton has not played well these last couple of weeks, that is for sure, but it's tough to imagine any quarterback having a ton of success with these pass catchers around him.
Okay, this is not really the line of thinking that I think is happening in New England, but is there any chance that Belichick is actually kind of okay with the way the season's going, because he's got all these injuries, they're not paying Cam Newton a whole heck of a lot of money, and he's loaded with draft picks for next year, and oh, he could get his quarterback of the future. Is there any chance that he's okay with, I don't want to say tanking, but with the struggles that this team has had of late?
I don't think so, just with the way that guy is wired and the way that he's handled himself and his team over these last two decades. Now, I don't think Bill Belichick, if he has the choice to kind of mortgage the future and sell out to try to win something this year or kind of maintain the franchise stability that they have, I think he would choose the latter there. I don't think he was going to kind of go out and make some super, super aggressive win now type moves. But I definitely wouldn't say he's happy with where the current state of the team is right now. I mean, it's been a very long time since they've been
in this sort of situation. And this is their multiple games below 500 for the first time since 2001. So that just kind of paints a quick picture of how unfamiliar this current territory is for those guys.
Okay, now with that being said, next week is the trade deadline. Do you think that there's going to be some pieces moving out? Because, as you said, you don't think he's going to make a move to mortgage any of the future, so maybe he makes a deal to get some more futures involved, maybe some draft picks or something.
Yeah, I wouldn't be shocked. I do think this weekend's game is probably going to kind of tilt their thinking one way or another. I don't necessarily think they're going in and saying, okay, well, if we win, we're going to be buyers. If we lose, we're going to be sellers. But if they're sitting there at 2-5 and the Bills are 6-2 after this weekend, I do think the outlook of the rest of the season changes a little bit. And regardless, I wouldn't be surprised if Stephon Gilmore does end up getting traded, even if they do win this week. Just because of his contract situation, it's going to be really difficult for the Patriots to keep him next year without giving him a pretty lucrative extension. And they don't typically do that with players of Gilmore's age, regardless of how talented he is. And he is one of the best cornerbacks in the NFL. So I would not be stunned if he is traded within these next couple of days. And if that doesn't happen within the next couple of days, I wouldn't be surprised if it happens over the off season. But yeah, so the short answer to your question is no, I would not be surprised if you see some higher profile Patriots traded over the next couple of days.
Okay. So they're not going to trade they're not going to trade a second round pick for Mohamed Sanu, which turned into JK Dobbins. Okay. Got it. Right.
Yeah, that was, I think that's going to go down as one of the more regrettable trades of the Belichick era. That's for sure.
Well, the good thing is when you have a million rings, you can just point to them when people get mad about trading away a second-round pick. Zach, thanks so much for the time tonight, and enjoy the game on Sunday.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys.
There we go. Zach Cox, Patriots beat writer, Nesson, co-host of the Nesson Patriots podcast. Again, I will remind you, tons of football on Sunday, starting up with the fantasy show at 8 o'clock. Then Inside the Lines at 10. That leads right in to the Bills and Patriots pregame starting up at 12:30. We'll have the game for you here on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. So, Matt, I don't think I've actually talked to you about this yet. Where are you at on the Tom Brady revitalization in Tampa and the Patriots looking, well, anything like what we normally think the Patriots look? What does this say about Belichick and Brady, conversely, if anything at all?
Honestly, I don't think that it changes anything. I think it's kind of expected with Belichick. They had a bunch of players that opted out this season, defensive players. They've had a bunch of injuries. I don't think Cam Newton is all that healthy. So having said that, I don't know if the expectations were all that high for me personally. I looked at that team and just said, you know, I don't think that they're very good. And you know, when you look at what's happened, it's pretty accurate. They're not very good. So the Tom Brady thing, I think we all thought he was going there with the intention of winning a Super Bowl away from Bill Belichick. And Tampa Bay wasn't going to bring him in and not surround him with pieces. So this is why they went out and got Gronk. Yes, he didn't start out all that great, but he's been really good the last 2 weeks. This is why they went out and got Antonio Brown. This is why they invested in the offensive line in the draft and in the offseason. So I can't say that I'm surprised, but it doesn't change my thinking. I don't think that the Bucks, you know, I don't think that they're the Super Bowl favorite. I think they're very good, but I still think that there's a couple of teams in the AFC that are better than them. I think if Seattle can improve their defense, they might be better than them as well. So having said that, I don't think you can recreate what Brady did with Bill Belichick in New England, and I don't think it tarnishes either of their legacies. If Brady went to Tampa Bay and failed, I wouldn't have thought anything less of Tom Brady than I already do, because he beat the Bills for 20 years or whatever it was. So I already think less of him as it is. But all kidding aside, if he went there and struggled, he's still one of the greatest quarterbacks to ever play the game. Maybe the greatest quarterback to ever play the game. And Bill Belichick struggles this year, don't change my mind that he's the greatest coach in NFL history. So I think for people to say otherwise is kind of hot takey and maybe a little bit unfair. But that's sports and the way people will judge others that play in them is always usually unfair. So I have no issue with either of them. I think it was good that they could showcase what they could do without the other. I think if Cam Newton was healthy and the wide receiving core was a little bit less banged up, I think you would see a different Patriots team. Remember, if you're losing like four guys off your starting 11 on defense, and you're losing, you know, an offensive lineman here, their offensive line is banged up. So there's just too much there to make a really valid assessment of what Bill Belichick is without Tom Brady.
No, I think that's very, very well said. And, you know, I think obviously Cam Newton not being the Cam Newton of old has definitely hindered kind of the way Belichick has gone about things. The one thing I'd say to that is, now, granted, there are kind of limits to everybody's powers, but this has been Bill Belichick's whole career, is making more of less. Or, oh, who are these guys? What? Who's Kyle Van Noy? What? He's an all-star. Like, he has his entire career taking guys that have been, you know, also ran elsewhere and turn them into Pro Bowl caliber players. Now, the one thing I think that we've probably given him too much credit for, and none to his assistants, is, and I don't think the assistants are deserving of the credit here, but it's the leaders on the team. It's one thing to lose a guy like Brady. It's another thing to lose a guy like Hightower. They've lost so many of the nucleus of the team, and then with the amount of guys who opted out heading into this season because of COVID, I'm not going to say that they never had a chance, but it just felt like Belichick had kind of, you know, when you're in any job long enough, you start to set it up so it's just easier for yourself. You're not working any less hard, you're just working smarter. And I think that Belichick had it set up where there were a lot of players who were acting as kind of de facto assistant coaches, position coaches. And when you remove those guys from the fold, I think that even a guy like Belichick, who has put such an incredible infrastructure in place, eventually it's just going to run out. And I think that's what you're seeing here. This isn't to say that if, you know, in a year or two, he's not able to get this machine running again, because I absolutely believe that can happen. But I just think right now he's just missing too many of his, you know, de facto assistant coaches, and that's why the year's gone the way it has.
Yeah, I can say that I can agree with that. Eventually, you can't just keep recreating these guys. He's lost Matt Patricia. He's lost Brian Flores. He lost Joe Judge. Like, those are three significant pieces that he's lost over the last, you know, two, three seasons. But here's my conspiracy theory. And it's going to be absolutely crazy. And I'm sure people will think it, but it's kind of funny. So Bill Belichick waits and waits and waits and gets Cam Newton for the absolute bargain basement price that he did.
Oh, okay.
The season starts out really well. And then the wide receivers get hurt. Bill Belichick doesn't bring in any wide receiving help. He makes Cam Newton kind of tough it out. Cam Newton's options are very limited, but Bill Belichick knows that he's still a great quarterback, so that he could sign him to a multi-year extension at cheap money, because Cam doesn't have anywhere else to go. And the Patriots then get Cam healthy. They bring in some wide receivers that they can overpay for. And then off the Patriots go yet again.
Do I buy it? No. Do I believe it? No. But do I love it? Yeah, that's what I do. I love that. I love that conspiracy theory. Just throwing some stuff at the wall. Maybe it'll stick. Who knows?
It's absolutely asinine. But I was thinking about it the other day, because Bill Belichick is the mad scientist. He just gets things to work. And in this case, I don't know. The thing is as ludicrous as it may sound, I don't think that anything's off the table when it comes to Bill Belichick. I guess that's what I'm saying.
I think anything and everything is on the table, except for Tom Brady heading back to New England. I think that ship has sailed. But other than that, just about everything is in play. One thing that's in play, maybe it's not, maybe it will be allowed, maybe it won't be allowed. I'll give you some clarity on body checking in the OHL. What's going on with that? We will hear from David Branch when we continue. Just a couple of segments left on Sportsnet tonight.
Send us all your money. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher, and we'll send you a free subscription for Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Absolutely free.
banger after banger from you tonight, Danielle. Great job by you right here. Great job by you for listening. Great job by J.R. Manithat putting together tonight's program. A little Destiny's Child, a little throwback. It's a Friday. I was about to say Thursday. Flashback Friday. There we go. What happened today? A little flashback. Very brief. Just this afternoon, OHL Commissioner David Branch was on Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Stephen Brunt. A lot of controversy about whether hitting will be allowed in the OHL this year. Well, let's hear from the commissioner himself. Here's David Branch on Writer's Block.
There are a lot of things I don't understand, but luckily we have David Branch, commissioner of the Ontario Hockey League, on, and he's going to reveal all to us right now. David, you're going to have to tell me how, if I, as a referee, how am I going to be able to, what is it, going to be a 2-minute penalty for body contact?
I was hoping you were going to carry on and explain how we could do it.
Yeah, no, I'm at a loss for this, my friend. I truly am.
No, I appreciate that. The interesting thing is that we all know we've got some challenges for our return to play, starting with the border situation, looking at the fact that right now we can't have spectators, et cetera, et cetera. The playing rules obviously are a factor of return to play, but we haven't even broached that. We haven't dug into that. And I really can only say that at the right time, there will be good discussion. And, you know, looking forward to that discussion, quite frankly. But we have nowhere even scratched the surface with it. And, yeah, it's as simple as that in my mind, Jeff and Stephen.
Well, let's, and again, I understand, and you do have a bit of runway here before this, you know, the tentative season's start is scheduled. So there, I assume there's a bunch of things in play here. But just to kind of put the body checking thing to bed as best we can, David, if the Ontario government, in fact, continues to say what, you know, Lisa McLeod seems to be saying right now, like today, saying that body checking won't be allowed, is that in any way a no-go for you guys? Like, would you say, okay, we will play with no body checking, even though body checking is, you know, kind of a fundamental part of hockey, and, you know, we're a little skeptical about exactly how risky that might be from a public health basis. Like, do you fight to try and fight that fight, or do you just say, okay, we'll try and make it work?
Yeah, Stephen, we haven't even contemplated that, quite frankly. And, I mean, at the end of the day, so much of what we're attempting to do is to provide the opportunity for our players to get back on the ice. And, I mean, we have to take them into consideration here and what's best for their development and ongoing development, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, if there's studies that really clearly state, point out that body contact is a contributor to the spread of the virus, then obviously we'll have to look at it. But we've not looked at it yet, and that's a bit of a hypothetical question, Stephen. So I don't wish to enter into that realm just yet.
Well, I'm sure we will. We will cross that bridge at some point, David. I understand what you're saying. So, okay, so let's talk about some of the other fundamentals here now. We have talked over the years at length about kind of the economics of junior hockey and the economic, you know, situations of some of your, you know, not all of your operators are in the same situation as others. It's a really, you know, there's a lot of different business situations in the different towns. If you can't put fans in the stands this season for this 40-game season, and I know that you're like every other sport, you're probably hoping that by the end of that season, maybe it changes and maybe you can get limited capacity. But if you're budgeting for this season with zero gate revenue, how are some of your teams going to get through it?
Some teams would be extremely challenged to do that. And somewhere along the line, at the right time, once we know exactly what the terms are going to be for being able to play. If it is no spectators, we're going to need some financial support. And that's something else that we must address with government, both federally and provincially, as we move forward here.
Has that discussion, like, again, we know that the Canadian Football League, for instance, went through that discussion in the fall with the federal government, eventually kind of fell on deaf ears. Have you entered into that discussion? And again, I know we're not talking hypotheticals. We're talking, you know, probabilities here, and I guess degrees of probability. But have you entered into that discussion with the provincial government or the federal government? Or, and again, the other question I would have you entered into that discussion at all with the National Hockey League? You know, are there other stakeholders here who might have an interest in you guys playing?
Yes, we have not entered into any discussion with the National Hockey League, nor do we wish to, quite frankly. They support us now under the terms of the player development agreement that we have with them. And it appears to me that they have some challenges possibly going forward as well. We've not introduced anything to the federal or provincial government yet, other than we must consider this at the right time, depending on conditions around financial support. As you may know, Stephen, in the province of Quebec, the Quebec Major Junior Hockey League-based teams, there's 12 of them, are each being funded significantly, I might point out, by the provincial government.
Mm-hmm.
And their teams in Atlantic Canada are not, but yet the teams in Atlantic Canada have been granted the ability to have a certain percentage of spectators right at their games. So they've got a bit of a blueprint there that we're all looking at. And I know that the Western Hockey League is also, you know, exploring that to see just what might be there, etc. So that's a very important piece to our return to play.
Now, we also know that the Q resumed play, then had a stoppage of play for the Quebec teams. Those teams are, I guess, finally scheduled, are going to return this weekend. In terms of the logistics of starting up, David, how much sharing of information has there been between the leagues? You know, and I'm talking about the logistics of testing and getting players to and from games and successfully concluding the game. Have you been able to tap into the Q's knowledge base yet? And has the WHL done the same thing?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, first of all, you know, adversity sometimes, you know, really, I think, sees other things develop which will be beneficial for the game, for leagues going forward. And hockey at all levels have really been open, starting with the National Hockey League. They have run a couple of special forums for us on return to play leagues like ourselves and our partners in the Canadian Hockey League, et cetera, are part of, along with other leagues in the U.S. But so that part has been really, I think, really, really important. But in terms of what you brought up about our partners in the Western Quebec, we have 3 conference calls minimum scheduled per week. And during each one, we trade off on experiences, best practices, et cetera, et cetera. And Quebec has been the leader. I mean, I give Gilles Courteau, their commissioner, you know, all the credit in the world that he's been able to affect some conditions that allow them, their team, to return and play. So, yes, we are learning. What we do and what we've all done, and in the OHL's case, we have submitted our return-to-play document with the province for their consideration. And where the province has been really good, it's not yes, no, or maybe. They look, they consider, and they come back and they give us some guidance. And I think that's been critical. And quite frankly, it's been a real positive takeaway. And I can say the same thing with the federal government and PHAC on the border crossings. Everybody's trying to help. Whether or not we can arrive at the necessary level of being able to do the things that are necessary for the best interests of the players, safety, and fans, et cetera, remains to be seen, certainly, here in Ontario.
Well, yeah, you mentioned the border, Dave. So let's talk about the other obstacle that you guys face, because, you know, and other sports have faced this as well, obviously, which is the international border. You have three teams in the States. The Dub has teams in the States. The border is open for some business traffic, but it is otherwise closed. There has not been an exception made for sports so far, although the Blue Jays tried to negotiate that. The situation is changing and fluid, but I like my math would suggest that you're going to be, by the time you guys go to training camp, if this schedule holds, you're probably not going to have an answer. The border's still going to be closed as it is now, and you're probably not going to have an answer about exactly when it's going to reopen. Do you have a plan in which those American teams play among themselves in the United States? Do you have a plan in which they relocate temporarily to Canada for player movement across the border? Like, it's, you know, this is all out of your hands, I understand, but I just wonder what, you know, how you've kind of game planned it.
Yeah, it's all part of the process. I mean, we've been challenging ourselves, Stephen, on various concepts, as you point out. You know, not unlike what undoubtedly, and I don't know this to be the case, but what Major League Baseball did, which resulted in the Blue Jays playing in Buffalo, you know, as an example. So we have three teams in the U.S., as you point out. In the West, they actually have five in the Pacific Northwest. So they have, I'll say, a situation, which isn't all that bad when you consider the fact that they can play within their division, and it's a good bubble, shall we say. With three teams, it becomes a little bit more awkward, and we're trying to address, just to what you said, how we can possibly do that. We don't ideally wish to relocate any of our teams, but we're hedging our bet that some things will start to open up. We'll have a clearer picture in the new year, and we'll be able to confirm our plans and how to best go forward here.
Dave, if everybody gets to the finish line here, you know, the Q and the Dub and you guys, what would Memorial Cup 2021 look like?
Well, as you know, Stephen, we had to cancel it last year. I mean, you know, we stopped play March 11th, couldn't complete our final portion of our regular schedule, didn't have any playoffs. So our desire is to ideally have a Memorial Cup. And I mean, it's the dates are June 17 to 27. We really pushed that as far as we could, we feel. And we're still hoping that we'll have a champion from each of the three leagues converging in Ontario, who's the host this year, in either Sault Ste. Marie or Oshawa, who have bid to host this year's tournament. So that model is still in place, and that's what we're hoping that we'll be able to do.
David, really good of you to join us. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeff.
Take care.
And as well, you, Stephen.
Yes.
Thank you.
Stay in touch, Dave. I think we'll be talking again.
I think so. Thank you.
Okay, sir. Bye-bye.
I got to be honest. I don't know that there's a guy I would want to interview, David Branch, more than Stephen Brunt. It feels like he always asks the perfect question. And boy, that was a great interview. Just played it for you. That's from Writer's Block. You can catch the entire interview, which you just heard, on the Writer's Block podcast. So, Matt, obviously, the whole there's no hitting in the OHL. I feel like people might have got a little bit ahead of themselves when that announcement came out today. That came from the Ontario government. We just heard from OHL Commissioner David Branch saying, not so fast. We're not there yet. So neither of us know if or what body checking will look like in the OHL. But both of us know this. If there isn't going to be body checking in the OHL, I don't know that you need to be playing those games this year. I understand if we can find ways to make kids hockey or your rec hockey or whatever else you're doing safer, great. Please, honestly, I implore everyone to find every possible way they can to find a way to do the things they love more safely. But for effectively professional sports, which is what the OHL and all these CHL leagues are, the idea of a no-hit league, it makes no sense. Never mind the idea that why is hitting worse than a face-off or a board battle in the corner. Like, Matt, I cannot wrap my head around this. Can you help me understand this at all?
No, I can't, Brent. No, I can't. This is, you know what it is? Non-contact hockey like that is a really, really good beer league. That's what that is. Like, these, it's the best beer league hockey that you're going to watch. It's better than the All-Star games because it means something. But how about this? So this was from one of our colleagues, Michael Grange, when Sportsnet tweeted out that the Ontario Hockey League will not have body checking this coming season, and Michael's response was this: just laughable. 6-hour bus rides? Fine. Dressing rooms? Fine. Benches? Fine. Face-offs? Fine. Breathing hard and flying around on skates, leaving a vapor trail? Cool. But hitting will spread COVID? I don't even care about hitting, to be honest, but this is next level dumb. Yes, yes, thank you, yes.
Grange nailed it there. The thing most likely to spread COVID will be that bus. I can assure you of that right now. I've never, I was about to say fortunate, I think unfortunate enough to have to ride on those buses, having talked with guys who have guys who have been in that experience. I would want no parts of that during COVID. I wouldn't want a lot of parts of it during non-COVID time. So yeah, I definitely think, that's where the most danger comes in. It just, I did not like this argument when it was made about what the federal government was doing with the Blue Jays, saying, oh, this is just for optics. You don't want to let them in for optics. I think this is a complete optics play by the Ontario government, saying, let's just take a big shiny thing that a lot of people pay a lot of attention to, and we don't want to do anything to take junior hockey away from them. We would never want to do that. We just want to show we can kind of flex our muscles a little bit. Like, that's what it feels like is happening to me. I saw the Minister of Sport. She was retweeting articles going, yeah, there won't be body checking this year. Like, it feels like this is just kind of a puff your chest out and posturing move by the Ontario government. And honestly, it's driving me nuts, Matt.
So why is it not allowed here, but the QMJHL is playing now, and the WHL doesn't have that same restriction? Again, I get it's different provincial governments, but in both the QMJHL and the WHL, this is multiple provincial governments that are getting on board with this. It's not just one like it is for Ontario. It's multiple. So I don't understand how it works. And Grange's point and your point about the bus rides, listen, I've been on those bus rides with 20-plus players and then staff on the bus. There's not enough room to socially distance on those things. So you can't tell me that that wouldn't be an issue. So I think this is just a bunch of hooey. It's like you said, they're just trying to make a statement. And for me, it's just not good enough. It's not acceptable. I understand you don't want people in the buildings and stuff like that, but don't tell me that, you know, are they gonna elongate the benches? Like, the benches are gonna be 50 feet long so that players can properly socially distance on there? Or, you know, when they take a face off, they have to take a socially distant face off? Like, what is this nonsense? You know what it is, Brent? It's garbage. It's absolute garbage. Either you let them play properly or you don't let them play at all. I would rather them say, you know what, you can't play, the OHL cannot play games. That would be a way better statement than, we'll just take out body contact. I'm sure that's fine. No, it's a bunch of trash is what it is.
No, you nailed it. Here's the thing. I think, don't get me wrong, people would complain about this. There would be a subset of people who would get their backs up and be ready to charge the gates of the provincial legislature if this happened. But if you deem it is not safe to play junior hockey and you look at all of the different things in regards to, okay, do we let people go to gyms? Do we let people play rec hockey? Do you let these other businesses go on? If you look at all those things and could explain your decision for why the OHL should not be allowed to run this year, I think the majority of people would say, I don't like it. But okay, I at least understand it. But the fact that you're just trying to go, we'll just do this, we'll just pull this one little lever here. Again, I'm trying not to get too political, but it comes back to this government's response for everything. It's, let's do the easy thing and not the hard thing. The hard thing to do would be to tell the OHL, guess what? You can't play this year. But they don't want to be the bad guys, so they're left up in this kind of limbo. I really, really hope that if there is going to be hockey, they just play hockey. If you can't do it, don't play it. That's kind of where I land at. I think you're on the same page as me.
Yeah, their approach was a half-assed approach. Honestly, it was. Yep. It was, we'll allow you to play, but no, in this situation, you're actually challenging the integrity of the sport by not having contact. That's one of the biggest parts of the game. One of the most important parts of the game is being able to separate man from puck. I mean, I'm so angered by this because, like, the fact that COVID has already taken development months away from some of these kids, and maybe by the time this gets started, could be a development year. I coach younger players, and this was supposed to be a really big year for us in terms of developing these kids. I have 2008, so they would be 12 years old this year, and they lost a huge chunk of the season because of this. So, and a whole summer with developing, and you know. What about the kids that are trying to go to the NHL from the OHL, or it's their draft year? This is a huge thing, and I understand, and I know people that are listening are probably saying, well, you're an idiot. The virus is more, like the health of these players is more important. Yes, I understand that. But if the health is more important to the government of Ontario, then you should just ban it, and that's it. Be done with it. Not this half-assed approach of, well, we'll just take contact out because I'm sure that'll solve the problem. That's junk. That's absolute junk, and I'm not here for it.
That's Gordon Bombay. No, it's not. It's not Gordon Bombay. It's Matt Marchese. I'm Brent Gunning. Got one segment left on Sportsnet tonight. And yeah, I echo all of that you said. I think we both agree. Look, if you can't do it safely, don't do it. There will some people be upset. Yes, they will. But you know what? What upsets a lot more people? Whatever this mushy middle that's going on right now is. What won't be a mushy end to the show? Well, this show. We got to wrap up our poll segment. Couple of kickers I didn't get to. Halloween's around the corner. Fun segment. One segment left on Sportsnet tonight.
As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake doctor's orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Hear this without thinking of the other guys.
Oh, dude, I was just thinking that. I was gonna say, if Brent doesn't say anything here, I'm going to. Oh my god, that honestly, one of the funniest movies that I've ever seen. It's so good.
It's incredible, and I think it kind of, oh man, this is as good a place to end the show as any, right in my wheelhouse, talking about Will Ferrell movies. I feel like it kind of gets lost in the shuffle. He was on such an unbelievable heater at the time. Obviously, Step Brothers, Anchorman, Talladega, like it's just movie after movie after movie. I'm not going to say it's slept on, because I think pretty much everybody understands how funny that movie is. But if another guy would have put that movie out, it would have been like Pantheon, put this on his, you know, Hall of Fame plaque, if you will. Like, that movie is incredible.
Yeah, it really is. And I feel like I read some story or heard something about it that the movie kind of came up as a joke. Like, him and Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg were having dinner or something one night, and they joked about doing like a buddy cop comedy, and then it ended up coming to fruition. I feel like that's what happened. So thank God for that dinner, because it gave us one of the funniest movies of all time. Like the scene where Will Ferrell talks about being the, when Mark Wahlberg's talking about being a lion, and Will Ferrell's talking about being a fish in the ocean, a tuna, and coming out with this school of tuna fish. They design a breathing apparatus made out of kelp. And like, it's the most ridiculous thing, but it's absolutely hilarious. It's one of the, like, if you haven't seen it, you need to see it. It's one of the funniest movies that you're going to watch.
And then Will Ferrell just deadpanning at the end of that conversation with, bet that didn't go the way you thought it would, did you? Mark Wahlberg having a ballet repertoire, you know, just to make fun of guys who could do that. Like, it's all so good. And yeah, to top it all off with a tremendous police captain, Michael Keaton, claiming to not be, but 1,000% quoting TLC throughout the entire movie. Yeah, that's incredible. I'm so happy we landed there, because boy, that's definitely a favorite movie of mine. Michael Keaton, great actor, played Batman, and was a tremendous police detective. So I want to wrap up our poll question before we step aside tonight. What's the scariest thing for a Toronto sports fan? And this wasn't an option, but the answer ended up being a Leafs fan, pretty much. 46% of people saying game 37 versus the Bruins. 38.5% of people saying a long-term injury for Austin Matthews. Of the four you put up there, overwhelmingly the Leafs getting results. We did have one person tweet into us saying losing Masai. That was David tweeting in on that, and I think we both liked that tweet, and I think we both probably had the thinking emoji face going, maybe we should have put that one in there, because that definitely would have got some more votes if we would have put it in the poll.
Oh yeah, for sure. And unfortunately I didn't think about it, but I feel like that really would have challenged Leafs Bruins game 7 and would have knocked Austin Matthews down a couple of pegs or two. But no surprise for me anyway. I just thought the Kyle Lowry injury would have been a lot higher, seeing what he's meant to this organization over the last half decade.
Yeah, I think what that was simply that if Kyle Lowry has a long-term injury, unfortunately, that's the start of the reset for the Raptors. I don't know that it'll be a rebuild. That'll all depend on what happens with Fred VanVleet. And unfortunately, like all things with the Raptors, it really depends on who exactly Pascal Siakam is. And boy, we talked about that so much throughout the course of the playoffs. It feels like everything for the Raptors' kind of next iteration rests on exactly what you feel like that guy is. I mean, for me, I think he could be your second best player on a you know, championship contender, but that first guy better be really good. And you know, I definitely think that's going to be kind of the fork in the road question for the Raptors going forward, is just what do they have in Pascal Siakam.
I think what we saw during the season, and not necessarily in the bubble, was what he was. He's a 20 plus point per night guy on a good team, but I still think that he's not the alpha. I think you're right. I think he could be a good second option, but he's never going to be the alpha, or at least from what we saw, he's never going to be the alpha. So he's a very good player, among the 20 best in the NBA, I think you could say. I think that's pretty fair, and they're certainly paying him like that, so he's got to step up. But I look at how he played during the season. A lot of guys didn't have they didn't play well in the bubble, and I think that's understandable. So with that being said, I'm okay with what Pascal Siakam brings to this team, and I think he's going to be just as good as he was during the season last year.
Now, let me throw one more Raptors-related terrifying thing. I guess Pascal Siakam being the player we hope he is the opposite of terrifying. But what if we included this in the poll question? Giannis contract extension in Milwaukee? Because it feels like a lot of people, more than they'd even like to admit, are really kind of banking on that to be the plan for the Raptors going forward.
I'm one of those guys, so a contract extension in Milwaukee would be a problem. I really think he's gone. I think that unless Mike Budenholzer is gone, which he may be if they don't have any playoff success again next year, because I just look at this situation, Mike Budenholzer does not adjust well in game. We've seen that. And the fact that he doesn't want to play some of his guys over 36 minutes or whatever, that's trash. So there's a lot of garbage, actually, that's been on the show tonight. I just look at that, and Giannis may have enough there. And when you talk about Giannis and free agency, he's not an American player. I think there is a stigma among American players, but for international players, I don't think that they have an issue coming to play in Toronto. So I think there's a really good chance that he ends up a Toronto Raptor. I wouldn't say it's an 80% chance, but I think it's better than 50-50.
Oh, that's what sports radio is made for, putting odds on a guy's free agency well over a calendar year from now. I asked the question. It's my fault. Matt, that was tons of fun doing the show with you tonight. Thoroughly enjoyed it. Want to let you know, tomorrow, busy day on the station. The golf show is going to kick the day off. Oh, yeah, the golf show is still going until the Masters. Then Sam McKee and Rob Wong have you covered in the morning after that. Sunday, boy, Sunday, it's a busy one. Bills and Patriots will be starting with the pregame at 12:30. Before that, tons of football with the fantasy show and Inside the Lines. Want to thank everybody who joined us tonight. Want to thank my co-host Matt Marchese, producer J.R. Manitet, and Danielle Furtado on the behind the glass on the Wheels of Steel. But most importantly, thank you for listening.